Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Crimes by Moonlight, Mysteries from the Dark Side, by Charlene Harris, editor. Performed by Jeffrey Cummings and Natalie Ross. Introduction. After years of belonging to the mystery community, I'm used to being regarded as non-threatening, good-natured, sometimes even, shudder, sweet. All that changed when I was asked to edit the MWA anthology that had been designated Supernatural. I sent out an email to some of my favorite writers, all MWA members, to let them know the good news. I was offering them a slot in Crimes by Moonlight. You would think I had offered to ship them a rattlesnake. Instead of greeting this golden opportunity with cries of glee, I got a batch of awkward emails that began, "Gee, I don't know, I've never written woo-woo." That's a highly technical industry term. "I don't know about trying to do a supernatural," they moaned. I had to practically poke some of my fellow writers with a sharp stick to get them in line. I must admit there were a few who did react as I'd expected. Some mystery writers were simply waiting for the chance to cross over to the dark side. I'm keeping my eye on them. In the end, my call for stories got some amazing responses. This volume consists of entries by writers you've read and loved for years, and writers who aren't well known yet. What all these writers have in common is their membership in MWA and their willingness to tackle an offbeat story element. Half the stories were ones I requested. The rest of the stories were submitted without any identifiers to a stellar panel of volunteer judges. Noted writers Daniel J. Hale, Dana Cameron, Doug Allen, Jane Cleland, and Heather Graham. The number of blind submissions came to more than 300. So my hat is off to these stalwarts, who may never volunteer for anything again in their lives. Barry Zeman oversaw the whole process from start to finish and was a great help. And John Helfers at Techno Books was willing to let me wail in his ear when the process got to be overwhelming. After all the work of writing, editing, selecting, re-editing, and literally hundreds of emails, here's the final result. Our work is done. Now all that remains is for readers to enjoy the result. We're counting on it. Charlene Harris. Dahlia Underground, by Charlene Harris. Dahlia Lindley Chivers woke up soon as the sun went down. But this awakening was like none she'd experienced in her long second life. On her back, pinned down and injured. Badly injured. Dahlia cursed in a language that had not been spoken for centuries. She'd lost a lot of blood. Though the air was filled with smoke and dust, she could smell a body close to her. The blood of the dead person was repellent, but it would help. She carefully extended her right arm to discover it was free and unbroken, unlike her left. Her left leg was immovable, though her right leg wasn't, because the beam trapping her lay at a slant. While she was evaluating her situation, Dahlia wondered what the hell had happened when she was in her day sleep. She heard distant screams and sirens, while around and above her lay destruction. A huge pane of glass, intact, had landed upright on a vampire, shearing him in half. Though he was beginning to flake away, he looked familiar. Her memory began filling in the blanks. The pyramid. She'd suddenly decided to spend the day at the pyramid, the vampire hotel in Rhodes. The disintegrating vampire had been a handsome male in the service of the Queen of Indiana, and she'd accepted an invitation to dally with him, rather than return to her room in the mansion of the Sheriff of Rhodes. Though the night had been notable, the day must have been more so. High above her, Dahlia could see a bit of night sky lit by flashes of artificial light. Every now and then there was an ominous creak or groan from the heap of twisted metal, shattered glass, and concrete. Dahlia wondered how long it would be before it shifted. She might yet end up in the same condition as her bedmate. Dahlia had not been afraid in a long time, but she was almost afraid now. She wasn't so afraid she was going to yell for human help, though. A smaller beam was lying crossways on the one that pinned her, very close to her right hand. Dahlia figured if she could grip the smaller beam, she'd get enough purchase to drag herself out. Then she could work her way over to the dead human, feed, and begin the perilous climb upward. She had a plan. Dahlia's right hand gripped the crossbeam, and she pulled, but she realized instantly that her left leg would rip off unless the heavier beam was lifted at least another inch. "Well," said Dahlia. "Crap." Dahlia was extremely strong, but extricating herself cost another hour. By the time her leg slid free, she was close to exhaustion. As she rested, she looked down at herself. Ugh. She was naked and streaked with dirt, soot, blood, and pale powdery dust. She held up a strand of her long, wavy hair, normally coal black. In the dim light, it looked white. She'd been there a while. How much time before dawn? She made herself move. The corpse was that of a uniformed hotel maid. Her neck had been broken in the explosion. Since she hadn't bled much, Dahlia was able to tank up. The blood of the dead was even worse than the bottled blood substitute that had enabled vampires to become legal citizens of the United States. The vampires could truthfully say they no longer needed to feed from live humans. Of course, they still enjoyed it much more. Dahlia lay across the maid's body, gathering strength for the climb up through the rubble. For a black moment, her normal confidence wavered, and she wasn't sure she could manage it.
"Hello!"
called a hoarse voice from above.
"This is Captain Ted Fortescue, Rhodes Fire Department. Anyone alive down there?"
She thought about remaining silent. Then she bit her lip. Dahlia was very proud, but she was also a survivor of no mean skill.
"I'm here,"
Dahlia called up out of the darkness.
"Human or vamp?"
"Vampire,"
she said defiantly, even though she feared he'd leave her where she was when he found out she wasn't a breather.
"Ma'am, how hungry are you?"
He'd been coached. Good.
"I've had the blood of a corpse. I will not attack you."
"'Cause we can have red stuff O-positive ready when we raise you."
"Not necessary."
"There's a corpse?"
"Two, Ted Fortescue. A vampire, though he's mostly gone. A human woman dead before I found her."
"We gotta take her word for it,"
said a lighter voice.
"Can you grip a rope if we send it down?"
Fortescue called.
"Yes,"
Dahlia said.
"If I try to climb, the ruins will shift."
Humans were going to save her. Humans. Though Dahlia hadn't wanted to build her character, after all these hundreds of years, it was apparently going to be built.
"Okay, here comes the rope."
The lifeline uncoiled about a yard from Dahlia. She pulled herself to it with her right arm, gripping the pieces of wreckage that looked most firmly lodged. Dahlia pushed herself erect. Luckily, she was a very small woman. She seized the rope with her right hand. Gritting her teeth, she wrapped her right leg around the rope and called,
"Pull!"
After a swaying, painful ascent, Dahlia Lindley Chivers emerged into a nighttime landscape of horror. One glance at Dahlia had Ted Fortescue bellowing for a blanket. The captain looked almost as battered as she did. His brown face was as dirty as hers, his close-shaved hair white from the powdery dust. Above his mask, his wide brown eyes were shocked. Dahlia found his smell enticing. She needed some blood very soon. But her need was drowned by the humiliation of having to stand with the man's support until her blanket was passed up. When he'd wrapped her in it with impersonal hands, Fortescue handed Dahlia down to the next human in line until she reached the base of the mountain of debris. The last person in the chain directed Dahlia to a line of humans waiting on the nearest clear sidewalk. She said,
"Those are people willing to give you a drink, ma'am. Please try not to go overboard."
"They volunteered?"
Dahlia tried not to sound disbelieving.
"Yes, ma'am. A lot of people are upset that the Fellowship of the Sun took such an extreme action against your people."
"The Fellowship is taking responsibility?"
"Yes. I guess they figured a vampire conference would be a prime target. Some of their own people hired on to the hotel staff, but they didn't feel the necessity to tell their fellow humans to get out before it blew. In fact, their news release says it served the staff right for serving vampires. Not too many people are happy with the Fellowship."
"My home is here in Rhodes. Is there a way I can get a ride to my house?"
"Get your drink if you want it, and then head over to that other line over there. They'll help you out."
"Thank you for your courtesy," Dahlia said stiffly. "Can you help me over to the donors? My arm and leg are broken."
Captain Ted Fortescue had descended from the mountain of rubble by that time, and he overheard Dahlia's words.
"Jesus Christ, why didn't you tell me?"
Ted Fortescue took Dahlia in his arms and carried her to the donor line on the sidewalk.
"Thanks so much,"
Dahlia said through clenched teeth.
"Where do you serve?"
"We're the 34 Company from the station at the corner of Almond and Lincoln. You gonna be okay now?"
She assured him she could stand on one leg while she fed. He needed to get back to his work, so he left her there. Dahlia watched him walk away. For a short time, she'd loved a werewolf. He hadn't been exactly human, of course, though close enough to cause her qualms. Dahlia had always felt the same kind of contempt for humans that most humans feel for Brussels sprouts. They were good for her health, but she didn't like their proximity.
The donor was a short woman with long white hair. Her name was Sue, she told Dahlia, and Sue held Dahlia's hand during the feeding. If Dahlia had been herself, she would have been put off by the woman's prattle about, "We're all one family." She didn't like her food to talk, but tonight was different. Having fed, Dahlia was able to hobble to the impromptu cab rank, where a free voucher got her a ride to her home. The vampires who lived in Cedric's mansion, already beside themselves with grief and rage, were glad to see a survivor come through the door. All Dahlia wanted to do was shower and crawl into her own bed in her own room in the windowless basement. The next night, all the Rhodes vampires met in the mansion's common room. At least 50 vampires from the central United States had died in the bombing, the newspapers said. Their deaths were not the worst part of the attack to this assemblage. The worst part was the loss of face. Their city had been targeted, and the attack obviously had been planned well in advance. But they had not detected it or forestalled it, though the plan had been devised and carried out by humans.
"We have been dishonored,"
Cedric, Sheriff of Rhodes, said. Every vampire in the city had been present at the meeting, from those who had their own homes to those who lived in the nest. Even Dahlia's friend Taffy, married to a werewolf, had been present. Cedric turned his large blue eyes on Dahlia. Pink tears glistened in their corners.
"Our sister Dahlia nearly met her final death and had to be rescued by humans."
"I accepted human help because it cut short the time I was trapped," Dahlia said, her back absolutely straight and her face utterly composed, though it was an effort.
"We must meet this challenge directly," said Cedric. "This is our city. Now we are at war."
The Vamps of Rhodes had not been at war since Prohibition, when some bloodsuckers from Chicago, frightened away by the aggression of Al Capone's henchmen, had tried to move into the tunnels below Rhodes. They'd survived one night.
"Tell us what to do,"
Taffy said. Taffy was tall and buxom, her physique emphasized by the slut biker outfit her husband Don favored.
"Taffy, you and Dahlia must visit the headquarters of the Fellowship. Get in by whatever means necessary. Look for membership lists. We want to know their leaders."
"This will have been done by the police," Taffy said.
"And will the police share with us what they found?"
Cedric had a point.
"I'll do whatever I can to bring the Whore Sons to justice," Dahlia said carefully. "But the lists will be on computers, and Taffy and I are not conversant with these machines." "One of the Arkansas vampires is adept with computers, but he was burned so badly he'll take time to heal," Cedric said. "Wait, I know someone."
He whipped out his cell phone again. It was the one piece of modern technology that thoroughly entranced the sheriff.
"His name is Melponius. He's a half-demon, and his services do not come cheap."
Cedric, who was cheapness personified, except when it came to maintaining his pride, grasped the financial nettle firmly. The half-demon was at the mansion within 30 minutes. He was a short man with reddish skin, a head of thickly curling chestnut hair, and pale eyes the color of snowmelt. When Dahlia greeted him at the door, those pale eyes showed instant admiration. Dahlia, though used to this, was nevertheless pleased. She was glad she'd worn her pink three-piece suit with the pencil skirt.
"I hope you're as good with modern technology as your reputation has it," she said tartly, and beckoned him to follow her to the common room.
"I love a good, strong vampire woman,"
Melponius said.
"Such a woman, if she is willing, can take a lot of energetic activity."
"I am several hundred years old," Dahlia said. "I assure you, I can take anything you could imagine handing out."
She didn't turn to look at the half-demon, but her lips curled in a little smile.
"You're older than Cedric,"
Melponius observed.
"But you're not the sheriff?"
"I don't want to be," Dahlia said. "And some think I'm not diplomatic enough."
"I remember your name now. It was you who broke the newscaster's arm."
"She wouldn't stop asking me questions after I'd warned her," Dahlia said reasonably. "I told her I would break her arm if she didn't leave me alone."
"Foolish woman,"
Melponius said.
"Deserved what she got," Dahlia agreed.
She was thinking that after the honor of the nest had been restored, she might find out what it felt like to kiss lips as full and hot as the half-demon's. Since hers were always cold, the sensation might be interesting.
Cedric greeted Melponius with appropriate dignity, mentioned a price, and Melponius agreed to accompany Dahlia and Taffy. When the three were setting out, Dahlia realized no one knew the location of the Fellowship's organizational offices. Taffy had to look it up in the phone book.
"This is the kind of thing detective novels don't cover," Taffy complained.
"You haven't read a detective novel since Agatha Christie quit writing," Dahlia said.
"Don't whine."
"She's quit writing?" Taffy was really put out.
"When did that happen?"
"She died, probably 50 years ago.
And why should I know that?"
"There have been plenty of novels since then. You should read some of them," said Dahlia, who seldom read herself.
"We've got the address. Let's pay them a visit."
In Taffy's Trans Am, they drove west into the old part of Rhodes. They left the Trans Am on Trask, which ran a block south of Field Street, the location of the modest storefront housing the Fellowship headquarters. The small businesses in the area had already closed for the night. The occasional pedestrian hurried along, since the evening was chilly. The three approached Field through a filthy alley 2 blocks west of their goal. Since they could all remember times when filth and debris were the norm, this didn't bother them. The two vampires and the half-demon hung in the shadows of a trash bin while they evaluated the Fellowship headquarters.
"Cameras,"
Melponius murmured.
"I see them," Dahlia said.
There were cameras all around the building. After a low-voiced discussion, Dahlia returned to Trask Street and ran silently east until she was pretty sure she was in line with the Fellowship building. She slid into the next alleyway and headed north. About halfway down the alley, Dahlia found a nice dark patch she didn't believe human eyes could penetrate. She crouched and gathered herself. She launched herself upward, landing neatly on the roof. Dahlia was confident that even the Fellowship wouldn't think of pointing a camera upward. She was right. After a quick smile of self-congratulation, she took off her designer heels and made a great leap, landing across the street on the roof of the 2-story building housing the Fellowship. She swung her legs over. Her fingers and toes clamped into the little spaces between the lines of brick, and she worked her way to the first camera. With a quick twist, she removed it from its mounting. She pitched the camera onto the roof, then did the same with all the others. Then she put on her shoes again. She waved at Taffy and Melponius, who began trotting toward the Fellowship. Dahlia leaped down from the roof to join them, landing on the sidewalk as lightly as a feather, though she was wearing 3-inch heels.
"Good job," said Taffy,
and Dahlia inclined her head.
"I'm impressed,"
Melponius said, looking at Dahlia's legs.
"Taffy, let's see who's minding the store."
Taffy knocked on the door, which bore the distinctive Fellowship symbol, a sun represented by a circle with wavy rays leading outward. Within the circle was a pyramid.
"What does the pyramid mean?" Taffy asked.
"Earth for humans. Eradication of vampires. Eternal victory,"
Melponius said.
"Kind of ironic that the hotel was the same shape. Maybe that sparked the plan."
A young man came to the door, through the thick glass. Bulletproof? The three could see he was a reedy Asian guy in his 20s with a soul patch. Taffy gave him her best smile and said,
"Young man, I want to come in."
If she hadn't called him young man, he might have unlocked the door, because Taffy had a great no-fang smile, and her tight leather pants added a powerful incentive. But the young roused his suspicion, since Taffy looked at most 25. He began punching numbers on a cell phone.
"Look at me,"
Dahlia said in a voice that managed to compel, even through the glass. And he did, no matter what he'd been taught.
"Open the door," she said.
And her voice was so reasonable that the young man did just that. Melponius immediately set to work looking at the Fellowship computers. Dahlia sat opposite Asian Soul Patch at a table covered with coffee stains and notepads. She said,
"What is your name?"
"Jeffrey Tan."
"Your Fellowship?"
"I hate vampires. I killed one myself."
"Did you really?"
"Yes, I did."
While Taffy searched the office building and Melponius began copying files onto a disk, Dahlia asked a few more questions. Jeffrey Tan had been dating a vampire, a girl he'd known before she went over. They'd been going at it hot and heavy one night, and she'd bitten him. Terrified, he'd stabbed her with a handy wooden chopstick. Unfortunately for the young vampire, Jeffrey's mother had brought him a traditional meal that day. In a flash, Jeffrey's lover had been shriveling and flaking on his bed. He had to live with himself, and the easiest way to do that was to find other people who thought he'd been perfectly justified.
Dahlia, who'd heard this sort of story many times before, had a fleeting moment of sympathy for Jeffrey, since she'd become reacquainted with Panic the night before. But she squelched the moment ruthlessly. She asked, "Did you help bomb the pyramid?"
"No, but I applaud the courage and determination of our soldiers,"
he said unconvincingly.
"Yes, slaughtering people who are asleep is brave. Do you know who planned and executed this action?"
"They're hiding. Getting ready,"
he said, his eyelids flickering furiously.
"The vamp lovers in the police department and the fire department who rescued vampires, they'll die next."
"Where are these heroes hiding?"
Dahlia asked. Malponius, who'd been looking at the screen of one of the office computers, said,
"I think I may have the membership list."
At nearly the same moment as Taffy pulled a large file out of the filing cabinet. "Here's a list of the properties they lease or own," Taffy said, as Malponius began downloading the list. "Oh, I checked out the basement. No one there." A phone began ringing. Jeffrey Tan reached for it, but Dahlia stayed his hand.
"What does the phone call mean?" she asked.
"I told them the cameras went out. They're calling to check on me,"
he said, and he seemed to be coming out of his trance. His gaze began flickering from Taffy to Dahlia to Malponius.
"You said the Fellowship was going after firefighters?"
Dahlia had a sudden misgiving.
"We have pictures of every traitor who worked the rescue at the pyramid,"
Malponius said.
"We'd better hustle."
"Shall I kill him?" Taffy asked.
"No, that would be too much of a red flag," Dahlia said.
"Though I'd enjoy it very much. Look at me, Jeffrey."
He couldn't disobey, but he was struggling.
"We were here to check for your leaders," Dahlia said, gripping his chin to force his attention on her. "They weren't here, so we left full of frustration."
"Yes,"
he said, his face slack again. The three left the building as quickly and quietly as they'd entered. In silent accord, Dahlia and Taffy flanked Malponius and held him, leaping to the top of the building. The three made their getaway across the roofs. By the time they'd gone 2 blocks, cars were parking in front of the Fellowship office.
"That was almost too easy," Dahlia said on their return to the mansion.
She and Taffy were drinking red stuff, and Malponius was sipping coffee, very strong and very black. Cedric had come to the common room to listen to their report.
"They left one human and such a puppy to guard the office. When they'd have to figure we'd be looking?"
"Humans do underestimate us," Taffy said. "Their thinking's limited."
"And we underestimate them," Dahlia snapped.
"Look who wiped out over 50 vampires at once. Even that puppy killed his girlfriend with a chopstick."
"I'm half human,"
Malponius said.
"Some of us are honorable."
Though Taffy and Cedric looked in another direction, embarrassed, Dahlia met his snowmelt eyes and inclined her head regally. Cedric said,
"What do you suggest we do, Dahlia?"
"This list of properties has to be checked out, as does the membership list," Dahlia said. "We'll be spread very thin, but I think we can do it. After all..."
She didn't have to emphasize their responsibility.
"You're in charge, Dahlia,"
Cedric said.
"Malponius, if you will come with me, Lakeisha will write a check."
"How will we do this?" Taffy asked when they had left.
"Divide into teams. Give each team a short list of properties to search," Dahlia said. "Each place must be searched very thoroughly, but very discreetly. One special team has to kidnap a Fellowship officer, a person without family. This team can't be averse to forceful persuasion. We need to know if there's some place not on this list. Perhaps a place belonging to one member that's large enough to hide 10 to 15 people. The newspaper said that's roughly how many Fellowship fanatics are missing. We'll check the people we can find against the list to get a better count."
Cedric returned in time to hear. He nodded.
"This seems sound,"
he said.
"Especially the torture part."
He smiled.
"Thank you, Sheriff."
Dahlia braced herself.
"Someone must be detailed to warn the humans involved in the rescue. They saved lives that night, not just human lives."
"Some of them were not pleased to rescue vampires,"
Cedric said.
"I read that in the newspapers, too."
"However they felt, they did it. We can't abandon those who've done us a service."
"Are you telling me my duty, Dahlia?"
"Sorry, Sheriff." Dahlia looked away to compose her face.
"This is very unlike you."
"I've never been hauled out of a pit before."
"The half-demon, The half-human would take no money for his service,
Cedric said.
He told me we were on the same side.
Dahlia tried not to look self-conscious. She mostly succeeded. Cedric nodded to Dahlia.
All right, go.
That was how Dahlia came to be walking into the firehouse of the 34 Company at the corner of Almond and Lincoln. Though the night was chilly, the door to the firehouse was open. The men and women inside were washing the fire trucks under floodlights. None of them whistled when Dahlia approached, though she was the center of attention in her black belted coat and black high heels.
A cold one,
said the biggest firefighter of all, a burly guy over 6 feet tall.
What you want, Vampy?
To rip your impudent throat out,
Dahlia thought. But she recognized his high voice. He had helped the captain haul her up out of hell.
I need to speak to Captain Fortescue, she said.
That brought a chorus of whistles and comments about Ted's wife and her reaction to his extracurricular pastimes. If Dahlia had been a breather, she'd have sighed. Ted Fortescue came out, wiping his hands on a towel. His men and women fell silent when the captain looked around to meet their eyes. He recognized Dahlia immediately, somewhat to her surprise.
Evening. Have you recovered from your broken leg?
I have, Dahlia replied. Her back was stiff as a poker. I have come to warn you. The people of the Fellowship of the Sun have said they'll take vengeance on those who rescued vampires.
They're going to target first responders?
Fortescue was appalled. Yes, Dahlia said.
They'll lose all public sympathy for their cause,
he said slowly.
Aside from the obvious point, they believe in killing vampires and recruiting humans.
I don't pretend to make sense of what humans do, she said. You saved my life. Now I am doing my best to save yours.
Well, thanks,
he said.
The firefighters looked from the captain to the vampire, obviously thinking he should say something else.
You were human once,
Fortescue said.
Dahlia was taken aback. She fumbled for a response.
I was a human for 18 years. I have been a vampire for...
She shook her head.
900 years, perhaps.
There was a little moment of total silence.
Good luck to you, Ted Fortescue, and to all of you who helped us,
Dahlia said. She looked at each face around her. She would remember each one.
I'll dispose of them all if I can,
she promised the firefighters, and then she walked away.
Commando Barbie,
one of the women muttered, but Dahlia heard her. In fact, she smiled a little, all to herself. Worry was not a familiar pastime for Dahlia, who was more of a direct action person. During the bit of dark remaining, Dahlia and Taffy visited two fellowship locations, a church on the south side and a meeting hall on the east. Both buildings were easy to break into, and the two vampires searched both very thoroughly. They were straightforward, modern constructions, no hidden passages, secret rooms, or false floors. The next night, similar results were reported by the other search teams. The Rhodes vampires felt the pressure. By the time they had to retreat to day sleep lairs, they'd only learned where the Fellowship plotters weren't. Their shame was mounting. Even the abduction and torture team reported failure. True, they managed to find a family-free Fellowship official, and true, they managed to snatch her unobserved. But to their immense irritation, the woman had a weak heart. She died too early in the proceedings to offer any useful information. In fact, the team simply restored her body to her house, and no one was the wiser. Taffy arrived at the mansion the next night, radiating excitement. She made a beeline for the common room. Dahlia was sitting at the table, lost in unhappy thought.
Dawn says we should look in the tunnels,
Taffy said, seizing her friend. Dahlia said,
if you shake me again, I'll break both your arms.
Taffy let her go with alacrity.
Sorry, I'm just so excited.
That's a very good idea, Dahlia said. We should have thought of the tunnels earlier.
The tunnel system lying below the original city center of Rhodes was extensive, and it had once connected all the major buildings in the area. The tunnels had seen much use in the years before and during Prohibition. In the decades since, some passages had been blocked up as part of new construction. Vampires seldom used the tunnels anymore, but they had in years past, along with all kinds of other creatures, including regular humans.
Do the tunnels run under Field Street?
Dahlia asked Taffy.
Dawn's faxing us a map.
Dawn, Taffy's werewolf husband had a friend who was a historian at Rhodes City University. Don's friend faxed the map to the little office where Lakeisha took care of Cedric's correspondence. Lakeisha had been an executive assistant in life, and Cedric had brought her over expressly to be his executive assistant in death. Lakeisha knew her office machinery and had a thorough grounding in modern communications, skills most of the older vampires found baffling. Lakeisha had had the advantage of knowing she was going to be brought over, so she'd had her hair washed, cut, and styled before her death. She was perpetually cute.
"I don't think you've ever gotten a fax before, Dahlia," Lakeisha said.
"I hope I never get another one."
"Grumpy, grumpy,"
Lakeisha chided. Dahlia snarled at her.
"Did we get up on the wrong side of the coffin tonight?"
Lakeisha said.
"It's annoying that you're not frightened of me, and it's a mistake."
"You don't want to make Cedric mad,"
the young vampire said calmly. Dahlia snatched up the tunnel map, and she and Taffy retreated to the common room to study it.
"Yes, we got you, assholes,"
Taffy said after the two had found Field Street and examined it.
"I'll give Don something nice,"
Dahlia said.
"Not a groomer's brush like you sent last time. That shit gets old,"
Taffy said.
"No, something really nice."
"Not another bag of doggy treats."
"I'm serious. It'll be very appropriate."
"Lakeisha, we need you,"
Dahlia called. Normally, Lakeisha would have insisted the request come through Cedric, but circumstances were hardly ordinary. Lakeisha used the copying machine and then the intercom. When everyone had assembled in the common room, she passed out copies of the map. Dahlia stood up on the hearth so they could all see her. She was wearing her black leather jumpsuit and was happily aware she was being admired. Melponius was there. She could see his curls and reddish face in the corner. Good.
"Thanks to Taffy, we've gotten a map of the tunnels," Dahlia said when the silence was complete.
"They run under the Fellowship headquarters, and if the leaders entered the tunnels after their attack against us, they may still be there. Has anyone here been down below the city in the last 20 years?
"I have," said Melponius. "I was in the tunnels 5 years ago, chasing an imp because, well, it's not relevant. There are more dead ends in the tunnels now than your map shows. The Fulmore Street tunnel is blocked with rubble at the intersection with Gill."
Pens moved over paper.
"The Banner Street tunnel is divided in the middle. Someone built a bank above ground and in the process made the tunnel impossible. Though I've heard someone's cut a hole in that wall."
Melponius went on to list 2 more closed or abbreviated tunnels.
"Thanks, Melponius," Dahlia said. "We owe you."
"Ha ha ha. I'll collect,"
he said, a gleam in his eye. It was a measure of Dahlia's reputation that no one sniggered. Cedric strolled through, carrying a pipe and wearing a smoking jacket. Taffy rolled her eyes at Dahlia.
"Do you have a plan of action, then?"
he said.
"Yes, my sheriff." "Good luck. Oh, by the way..."
Every vampire froze.
"You must bring them back alive,"
Cedric said.
"I know you want to have fun with them. In fact, I'd planned to ask you to bring me one to play with. But I've gotten a phone call from the chief of police who said, and I think this is interesting, that some of his officers told him they'd been running across vampires in unexpected places, asking unexpected questions. And he certainly hoped we weren't taking any vigilante action of our own, since the whole Rhodes Police Department is anxious to bring the Fellowship terrorists to justice."
None of the vampires cast guilty looks at each other. They were all much too seasoned for that.
"Of course we were planning to kill them," Dahlia said. "What else?"
"I'm afraid you must alter your plan,"
Cedric told her, using his sympathetic but firm voice that carried so well.
"Think of how wonderful it will look. A picture of you handing over the culprits to the police. Think of how people will say that we've honored our commitment to refrain from taking human blood, even the blood of our enemies."
Dahlia looked mutinous.
"Cedric, we'd anticipated
having a good old-fashioned party," he said. "I regret that, too. But when you find these murderers, they go to police headquarters, undrained and intact."
And in turn, every head nodded. Five teams of two vamps each had been dispatched to the five tunnel accesses closest to Fellowship headquarters. Dahlia thought it possible the bombers had blasted or cut through some of the more recent walls. She would have done so if she'd been planning on using the tunnels as a refuge. These teams were armed with shotguns. None of them were happy about it. Most vampires, especially the older ones, thought carrying a gun implied a certain lack of confidence in one's own lethality. Dahlia divided the rest of the Rhodes vamps into two parties. Each would enter the tunnels about a mile away from Fellowship headquarters, one from the east and one from the west. That way the hunting party could descend without alerting their prey. A couple of cars took Dahlia's party. Taffy headed the other one, to the east entrance she'd selected. This access happened to lie below a restaurant that had opened before World War I. The Capellini's Ristorante staff was used to parties trailing through on the old Rhodes tour, but they were taken aback when the 8 o'clock tour party consisted wholly of bloodsuckers. Dahlia hung back. Though she was tiny and pretty, she was also unmistakably menacing. Lakeisha beamed her perky smile, tipped heavily, and the atmosphere relaxed. The party, which consisted of Dahlia, Lakeisha, and three male vamps, Roscoe, Parnell, and Jonathan, all passed through a door the teenage tour guide had unlocked. They descended the stairs into the Capellini basement. The very nervous young woman pointed out how various things were stored, talked about when the building had been erected, and revealed how many pounds of pasta the restaurant had served since it had opened its doors. Though the vampires gave her polite attention, she was visibly nervous as she prepared to enter the old tunnels. She unlocked yet another door, this one a very old wooden slab. Greeted by a rush of cool air, the party descended a very narrow flight of stairs, then a steep and twisting ramp, and came to yet another door, much lower than modern doors and heavily locked. Their guide unlocked the last door, keeping up her patter the whole time, though with an effort. She flipped a light switch, and the tunnel appeared, running straight for about 10 yards before turning to veer right. Lakeisha said, "Let me ask you a question." Relieved, the girl looked at the cute, dark-skinned vampire inquiringly. Lakeisha said, "See how big my eyes are?" The next minute, the girl was under. "Sit on the floor here and wait until we come back," Lakeisha said, and the girl smiled and nodded agreeably. The vampires were all used to enclosed spaces, and they all had excellent vision. Dahlia barely seemed to touch the ground as she began to move forward. At first, two of them could walk abreast. After the jog to the right, the old tunnel narrowed. The walls were brick, plastered here and there. Every now and then, the narrow space widened into a storeroom, littered with old signs, broken chairs, all sorts of debris discarded from the businesses above. From time to time, a ghostly door, sometimes with glass panels still intact, offered access to an underground saloon or whorehouse that hadn't seen a customer in 70 years.
"This is great," Roscoe said.
Though Dahlia didn't reply, she agreed completely. They didn't meet any other tours because Cedric had booked them all. For 2 hours, the vampires owned the tunnels below Old Rhodes. Dahlia brought the party to a halt when she figured they were 2 blocks away from Field Street. She whispered,
"You heard, Cedric. No killing. If they resist, you can break a bone."
Despite the embargo, they were all tense with anticipation. It had been a long time since a worthy battle had come their way. This was a good moment to be a vampire. With a sharp nod, Dahlia turned and raced down the last section of tunnel. In the end, the conquering of the Fellowship bombers was almost anticlimactic. There were only 7 conspirators below the Fellowship headquarters. Of those, 2 had been too close to their own handiwork and had been injured by flying debris from the pyramid. Only 3 men resisted with any determination, and Taffy, who got to the group seconds before Dahlia, had subdued the largest of these with no trouble at all by kicking him in the ribs. Jonathan and Roscoe took care of the others. Rather than herd their hostages back to Capellini's, Dahlia decided to surface at the closest access point. Lakeisha used her cell phone to call the 2 vampires guarding that spot, their signal to alert the police that there were prisoners to deliver. Instead of feeling triumphant, Dahlia found herself doubtful. Surely there should have been more Fellowship people in hiding.
"Wait!"
she called at the first flight of stairs. She turned. Taffy, right behind her, was carrying the man whose rib she'd broken. He was groaning, the noise irritating her. To make sure a rib didn't puncture the human's lung, Taffy was carrying the man in front of her. Dahlia looked into his unshaven face.
"What's your name?"
she asked, and the man began to recite some membership number the fellowship had allotted him.
"That's even more irritating than the pain noises," she said. "Shut up, asshole!"
He cut himself off in mid-number. The practical Lakeisha extracted a wallet from his pants.
"This particular asshole is named Nick DeLeo."
"Ever talked to a vampire before, Nick?"
"I don't deal with hell spawn,"
the man said.
"I was not spawned by hell. I met with something much older than myself in Crete, more years ago than you can imagine. I will still be here when your children are dust, if anyone deigns to breed with you."
That seemed doubtful to Dahlia.
"Where are the others?"
"I'm not supposed to tell you that," he said.
It was hard for him to look formidable when a woman was carrying him, and he gave up the attempt when Dahlia came even closer. He flinched.
"Yes," Dahlia said with some satisfaction. "I'm truly frightening.
You can hardly imagine the pain I'll cause you if you don't tell me what I want to know."
"Don't tell him, Nick!"
A scream effectively ended another hostage's exhortation.
"Oh, Roscoe, is he hurt?"
Dahlia asked with patently false concern.
"Hard to lend his buddy moral support with a broken jaw,"
Roscoe said.
"Oops."
Dahlia smiled down at Nick.
"I have ripped people apart with my bare hands, and I enjoyed it, too."
Nick believed Dahlia.
"The others have gone to get the firefighters who fished the vamps out of the pyramid,"
he said.
"It's easier to get the firefighters. They're not armed. Three of us are going to each station around here that responded. They're going to shoot until their weapons are empty except for one bullet. And then they'll kill themselves. Holy martyrs to the cause."
"That's a terrible plan," Lakeisha said.
"You think this will discourage people from helping vampires? Make them want to join your stupid fellowship? The slaughter of public servants?"
"We have a new goal," Dahlia said. "We deposit these losers with the police. We go to the places they're going to attack. They have a head start on us, so let's be quick."
Up the stairs they swarmed to be met by media galore. The police knew a good photo op, too. As soon as possible, Dahlia and her nestmates faded away into the shadows. The others had their own assignments, but Dahlia herself ran full tilt toward the corner of Almond and Lincoln. Four of the pyramid conspirators were converging on the 34 Company. At least the big doors were shut. The firefighters inside were cooking, sleeping, playing video games, until the first rifle shot whistled through the upstairs window, missing one of their drivers by a hair. Then shots were pouring into the station from all directions. There was screaming and cursing and panic, until one by one, the rifles stopped firing. The newspaper photographers would have liked to take a picture of the four fellowship members piled in a heap on the concrete in front of the station, with Dahlia standing on top of them. But Dahlia was too clever for that. Instead, the next day's paper had a wonderful picture of tiny Dahlia in her black leather jumpsuit in the center of a huddle of firefighters, hoisted up on the shoulder of Captain Ted Fortescue. Any tendency the fire company might have had to rhapsodize sentimentally over Dahlia's one-woman anti-terrorist action was dampened when they got a good look at the broken bones and bloody injuries the 5-foot-nothing vampire had inflicted, though all four gunmen were alive, at least for a while. The newspapers were happy with their pictures. The firefighters were happy to be alive and mostly uninjured. The fellowship fanatics were secretly glad to be out of the tunnels and to anticipate reiterating their inane credo at their trials. Cedric was happy that his vampires had obeyed his direction, and the vampires felt they had at least made a beginning on their revenge for the pyramid bombing. Happiest of all was Melponius the half-demon, because he and Dahlia celebrated the victory until Melponius had to crawl back to his demon brethren with weak knees and a silly grin. As for Dahlia, she developed a strange new habit. She felt she had established a relationship with the men and women of Company Number 34. She began to drop in from time to time. By her third visit, the humans were matter-of-fact about her presence. Ted Fortescue absentmindedly offered her some chili instead of the red stuff they'd started keeping at the back of the refrigerator. When the City Council of Rhodes voted to give Dahlia a special commendation for her defense of the firehouse, everyone from the 34 Company attended.
"I feel like they're my pets," Dahlia confided to Taffy.
Taffy wisely hid her smile. And when one of the shooters was released on a technicality, and every firefighter in the 34 sounded off about it while Dahlia was there learning how to play Grand Theft Auto, none of the firefighters were surprised when the shooter vanished 24 hours later.
"Dahlia's like our mascot," said one firefighter to Ted Fortescue. "She'll be around a lot longer than we are," Ted Fortescue said. "Especially if you ever say anything like that where she can hear you."
But no one was foolish enough for that.
Hixton, by William Kent Krueger. A couple of miles outside the little town of Citadel, Wisconsin, the gravel road dropped into a tree-shaded hollow, and beyond that lay marshland. As soon as he cleared the trees, D'Angelo saw the cabin. It sat back from the road a full quarter mile. The turnoff was marked by a wood-burned sign that read, "Hams, smoked and honey-cured." He drove his new 53 Studebaker Starliner down a narrow dirt causeway between sinister-looking pools of dark water full of cattails gone brown. The high ground where the cabin stood also held a sturdy barn, an animal pen, and a large garden plot littered with stubble from a recent harvest. In the backyard, a young woman paused in hanging the wash and watched him come. The sheets on the line hung heavy in the still air, white against the gray of the overcast sky and the brown of the marsh reeds and the black of the water. An old man sat in a rocker on the front porch. When D'Angelo got out of the Studebaker, he saw that the old man's lap was crossed by the barrel of a shotgun.
"Far enough,"
the old man said before D'Angelo had even taken a step. "Greet all your customers this way?"
"Until I'm sure they're customers. A wonder you sell anything." "No wonder once you taste the product. You a customer?"
"What do I look like?"
"A man who answers a question with a question."
D'Angelo smiled.
"Heard in town that you make the best hams this side of the Mississippi." "Any side of the Mississippi, mister."
"You smoke the hams yourself?" The old man gave a brief wave toward a smokehouse in a far corner of the yard.
"Right over there. What's your pleasure? Hickory smoked or honey cured?"
"Hickory smoked will do." The old man nodded but didn't move. He studied D'Angelo carefully.
"Whereabouts you from? 'Cause you're not from around here."
"You neither," D'Angelo said.
"We're talking about you right now."
The old man's grip tightened on the shotgun.
"Nebraska," D'Angelo said. "Place called Hixton." "Hixton?"
The old man leaned forward.
"Son, it's not ham you came for. What do you want?"
"Just to talk."
"About what?"
5 missing boys in Hixton."
"Hixton was a long time ago and far away from here."
"Then there's no harm in talking."
"What's your name?"
"Martin."
"That a last name?"
"Last name's D'Angelo. And you're Albert Gorman."
"Why you want to know about Hixton?"
"I'm a newspaper reporter, Mr. Gorman. I'm working on a story."
"No one cares about Hixton. Too long ago."
He was more than 70, with a face parched by the sun. The squint of his eyes may also have been due to the sun, but D'Angelo thought not.
What the hell?"
Gorman finally said and beckoned his visitor forward. There was another chair on the porch. D'Angelo took it, wondering if it was where the young woman sat with the old man.
"How'd you find me?"
Gorman asked.
"It's what I do. Find people. Find things. Find the truth."
"The truth?"
Gorman laughed, a sound as parched as his face.
"People don't want the truth. If they looked straight at the truth, it'd scorch their eyeballs right off their skulls."
Several swine trotted out from a small structure inside the pen D'Angelo had seen on his approach. The animals came to the fence and stuck their pink snouts between the rails. Beyond the pen lay the marsh, which stretched away in all directions under the dismal sky. D'Angelo said,
"It would be difficult for someone to come at you without being seen." "Damn near impossible,"
Gorman agreed.
20 years ago, you left Hixton in a great hurry. What were you afraid of, Mr. Gorman? And what are you afraid of still?"
Through that squint of his eyes, the old man studied the marsh. He finally said,
"What do you know about Hixton?"
This is what D'Angelo knew and what he told Gorman. In the fall of 1933, a teenage boy named Lester Bennett attended a dance held in the gymnasium at Hixton Senior High School. He'd gone without a date. A shy boy, he hadn't danced with anyone. He'd left alone and had never made it home. 2 months later, another boy, Skip Grogan, age 16, went out at 4 a.m. to do his morning newspaper route. He was a quiet but conscientious kid, no friends to speak of, an only child, and his mother doted on him. He delivered half the papers that morning, from State Street to Maine, but delivered nothing after that. Like Lester Bennett, he simply vanished. In February, a kid named Jason Weller went for a hayride sponsored by the Kiwanis Club. He was an awkward kid who reluctantly accompanied his cousin, a girl in need of a date. They nestled in the hay of the wagon with lots of other teenagers. Afterward, they drank hot chocolate and ate sugar donuts around a bonfire. Then he walked his cousin home under a full moon, said goodnight, and was never seen again. The people of Hixton were understandably upset. They raised a hue and cry and demanded to know why the authorities didn't have a clue about the missing boys. The local police asked for the help of a state investigator. Albert Gorman was sent in answer.
"Sorry, sons of bitches, those local cops," Gorman said. "I took one look at their case notes and knew the only way they'd get their man was if he walked into the office, confessed, took the key, and locked himself in a cell."
"Did you think you'd have better luck?" D'Angelo asked.
"Luck? Wasn't any luck to it. Solving a crime is simply the steady elimination of possibilities."
"What were the possibilities?" Gorman rocked back in his chair. He lifted the shotgun from his lap and leaned it against the cabin wall, still within easy reach. He folded his hands over his belly, which had probably once been hard and flat, but with time had grown doughy. He wore a white shirt open at the collar, the thinner white of an undershirt visible beneath. His khakis were spotless and pressed to a sharp crease. His boots were black and shined. D'Angelo wondered if it was the young woman in the backyard who took such good care of him.
"First, I looked at the commonalities," Gorman said. "All teenage boys, all attending high school, all socially inept and isolated, all caught alone in the dark. This suggested to me that the victims weren't chosen at random. They'd been carefully selected by someone who knew them and knew their activities and their schedules. So I asked myself, who would have that kind of knowledge of all these boys? My answer was someone at the high school. A teacher, maybe, or counselor, or administrator. It probably wouldn't be someone who'd been there for a while, or the disappearances would have begun earlier. So I looked at those who were new to the school that year. There were only two. An English teacher, Miss Evelyn Hargrove, and the baseball coach, Hank Abernathy. Miss Hargrove was a wisp of a thing from Alabama, fresh out of college, all fluttery and feathery and smelling of exotic scents, and the boys in school were gaga over her. She lived in a rooming house with three other single women, and they all did everything together and knew each other's habits intimately and played canasta every night that they didn't have dates, which was the case more often than not. Turned out on two of the three nights that a boy went missing, Hargrove was playing canasta. So I turned my full attention to Abernathy. Now there was an odd duck."
A cabin door opened, and the young woman D'Angelo had seen hanging the wash stepped outside. She was pretty, with fair, soft skin, eyes dark blue as a sky sliding into nightfall, long black hair, and she smelled of fresh laundry. She wore a plain white dress that reached to her ankles, and the collar ran just below the fragile hollow of her throat. When she appeared, the swine in the pen began an uproar of grunting. To D'Angelo, who knew nothing about pigs, it appeared that they might be hoping she had slop for them, or whatever it was that they were fed.
"Excuse me for interrupting," she said with a pleasant smile. "I just wondered if you gentlemen might care for a refreshment."
Gorman said,
"Mr. D'Angelo, this is my daughter. Sweetie, this is Martin D'Angelo."
She said, "Would lemonade and cookies appeal to anyone?"
"Fine with me,"
Gorman said. "I'd like that," D'Angelo replied. and he watched the tilt of the young woman's hips as she turned and the undulating slope of her ass as she walked away.
Mr. D'Angelo,
the old man said. D'Angelo returned his attention to his host.
You said Abernathy was an odd duck? Talented athlete. Could have played in the majors, but what did he do? He coached in a little town in the middle of nowhere. I asked myself why a man would do that. What he was running from. Hiding from.
Was he married?
Nope. And that was another unusual thing. Good looking as they came, but he had no wife. No sweetheart.
Through an open window drifted the sound of Gorman's daughter softly singing. Listening to the haunting lilt, D'Angelo almost lost the thread of his thoughts. With an effort, he pulled himself back and said,
What did that suggest to you?
I figured maybe he was the kind of man who had no interest in women. And if that was true, it might point toward an explanation for the missing boys. But I had no evidence, no proof, and it would have been stupid to tip my hand. So I put men to watching him.
And then the fourth boy disappeared, D'Angelo said.
Yep. Early spring. 2 months after the last kid.
Edward Greeley, D'Angelo said. A young man with ambition, desire for Broadway or the movies. He had the lead in the senior class play, The Boyfriend. After the final performance, he went to a cast party at the home of Gwendolyn Murdoch, the drama teacher who directed the play. She caught him spiking the punch with rum from a silver flask he'd brought, which she confiscated. She gave it to the police during their investigation.
You've done your homework, Gorman said.
What about your surveillance of the baseball coach?
According to the man I assigned to him that night, Abernathy went to the movies and then to a diner for a late meal. He was sitting on a stool, eating, when Edward Greeley left the party and vanished.
Which effectively eliminated him as a suspect?
Pretty much. From what I understand, he eventually married a librarian in a neighboring town, so maybe he was just going through a period of adjustment in Hixton. Who knows?
Where did that leave you?
Looking for other possibilities.
Gorman's daughter shoved the screen door open with her hip and stepped onto the porch, holding a plate of cookies in one hand and a pitcher of iced lemonade in the other. D'Angelo stood up quickly.
Let me help you.
The pigs near the marsh set up a rage of grunting again, but the young woman ignored them.
Thank you,
she said sweetly. She handed D'Angelo the cookies and set the pitcher on the wide flat of the porch rail.
I'll be right back with glasses.
D'Angelo was tempted to follow her into the dark of the cabin, but Gorman's voice held him back.
Sit down. We haven't finished talking.
D'Angelo placed the cookies next to the pitcher and returned to his seat. The swine had fallen silent again, but continued to stare at the cabin.
Other possibilities? He said.
Gorman nodded.
I figure there was some other common thread to the boys that I wasn't seeing. I racked my brain trying to think what it could be. The pressure from the local police and from the populace was tremendous, I can tell you. I lost a lot of sleep thinking it through.
Gorman's daughter returned with two glasses and poured lemonade for both men. She asked,
Have you tried one of my cookies, Mr. D'Angelo? They're just sugar cookies, but I do a pretty good job with them, if I do say so myself.
D'Angelo took one, bit into it, and thought he'd never tasted a cookie quite so delicious. And he told her so. She smiled, a blush rising in her cheeks, and D'Angelo decided he'd never seen a young woman so beautiful.
Finish your cookie, Mr. D'Angelo, Gorman said. We still have talking to do. Leave us, sweetie.
She left them. D'Angelo finished his cookie, sat down, and felt an immense emptiness in the wake of the young woman's departure. A deep longing for her rose in his chest.
Like I said, Gorman went on, I lost a lot of sleep thinking it over. I looked at their friends, but they didn't have many and none in common. I looked at people in town they might all have had contact with. A minister, maybe, or a postman. Nothing there. Early on, I'd looked at the routes they'd all taken on the night of their disappearance and didn't see anything of interest. But I revisited that possibility, and without the blinders of a particular suspect narrowing my vision, I saw something.
The young woman's voice came through the window again, and her song was like a soft rope wrapping itself around D'Angelo's heart and pulling it to her.
What did you see?
He asked absently.
That their paths all crossed at the sweet shop, a little confectionery in Hixton. It was a relatively new establishment run by a woman named Circe Kane. I talked to the parents of the missing boys, and they told me their sons liked to frequent the shop, dropping in after school or on Saturdays. They talked with great affection about Miss Kane and about the wonderful sweets she served. So I began to investigate this Kane woman, trying to discover her background before she'd come to Hixton. And you know what, Mr. D'Angelo? I hit nothing but dead ends, which in itself told me a whole lot. I began watching the sweet shop and Miss Kane myself.
And then the last boy went missing? D'Angelo managed to say above the swirl of fog that seemed to be filling his head.
That's right.
He was a boy who'd graduated and was preparing to go into the army, D'Angelo said. He spoke slowly, deliberately, as if he were a drunk trying to make sense.
Yes, Gorman said. One night he took his little brother to a movie, and when it was over they went to the sweet shop. Afterward, he delivered his brother home safely, then returned alone to the sweet shop. It was late, almost midnight. Main Street was deserted. He stood on the sidewalk in front of the confectionery, where earlier he'd had lemonade and a sugar cookie, and he listened to the song Circe Kane sang to him through the upstairs window. He reached for the door and found it unlocked, and he went inside and never came out. And no one saw him do these things.
No one except you, D'Angelo said. Gorman nodded.
Except me.
Why? D'Angelo stood up, struggling to keep his thinking straight, to fight against the current of the song inside his head that was drawing him further into the fog. Why didn't you do anything to stop him?
Oh, I tried, Gorman said. I slipped in after him and followed him upstairs where Circe Kane lived. I listened at the door, and what I heard I couldn't believe.
What? D'Angelo asked, desperately trying to stay with the old man's words. What did you hear?
Circe Kane talking low and sweet to that boy, and I heard the boy answering. At first it was his own voice, but slowly that changed until what came from him was the sound of an animal.
What animal? A pig, Mr. D'Angelo, the young woman said in a lilting voice as she stepped from the cabin door. I find them such wonderful little creatures, sweet and loyal and, in the end, quite delicious. D'Angelo turned to Gorman as the world around him tilted and reeled.
Why didn't I tell someone? Because, Mr. D'Angelo, who would believe such a story? No. I left my job and left Nebraska and came with Circe to this place, where I've done my best all these years to protect her secret and keep her safe. Here, as you so correctly pointed out, I can see all that approaches. We have enough of those pesky traveling salesmen drop by that Circe's little pen over there is never empty. And this marshland around us, it swallows a car without a trace, believe me.
Gorman looked at Circe with deep contentment.
In return, she's fed me. There's nothing she can't coax from the earth. She's a marvelous housekeeper, cook, and companion.
He reached out and ran a wrinkled hand over the soft, fair skin of her forearm.
She has other charms as well, which I'm sure you can easily imagine.
D'Angelo felt his legs grow weak, and he collapsed into the chair.
D'Angelo, Gorman said. I know that name. The last boy in Hixton. His name was D'Angelo, too. And his little brother would be about your age now, if I remember correctly. A newspaper reporter, Mr. D'Angelo? I think not. I think you came looking for an answer.
D'Angelo? Oh, yes, I remember that one, Circe said with genuine delight. Such a sweet thing, and he fattened up so nicely, too. She reached out and touched D'Angelo's leg in a way that made him feel like livestock appraised for auction. And then the fog enveloped him completely, and he fell into a place as dark as the marsh water.
He woke in a bed that carried the fresh smell of clean sheets dried on a clothesline. There was another scent as well, something exotic and deeply intoxicating. And there was the unmistakable softness of a woman's bare breast pressed against his shoulder. He turned his head on the pillow and found her gazing into his eyes, her own eyes the deep blue of desire. Without a thought, he made love to her. It was glorious and like nothing he'd ever known. Later he woke again, and the cabin was full of the wonderful aroma of a meal cooking. He found her in the kitchen, wearing a long flowered apron over her simple white dress. "Sit down," she said cheerfully. "Dinner's ready." He sat at the table, still a little benumbed. "Where's Gorman?" "Albert served his purpose for many years," she said. "But it was time for someone new. I like you. You found me. Not an easy thing. You suspected the danger, but you came anyway. And you did it because of your brother. Intelligence, courage, and loyalty. Traits I've always greatly admired. Ulysses was much the same." She came to his side, set a plate of food in front of him, bent, and gently kissed his shoulder. "You know," she said, "you even look a little like him." D'Angelo stared at her adoringly and murmured, "I'd forgotten you. But you look the same as you did all those years ago in the sweet shop." He glanced down at his plate, which Circe had filled with herbed potatoes and green peas and applesauce. At the center was a steaming slice of pork loin cooked to perfection. "The meat might be a little tough," she said, sitting across from him and taking up her napkin. "The swine it came from was much older than I prefer, but I have always hated to waste a good pig." D'Angelo hesitated only a moment and then dug in.
Small Change by Margaret Maron. I'm lying on the backward-facing seat of an SUV that is being driven much too fast, and I'm rigid with apprehension. One could swerve and I could roll off the seat and bang against the rear window, and then what? Would I break something crucial? Be maimed for life? When I laid a trap to catch the thief that was ripping off my dad's antique store, I never dreamed I'd get trapped, too. At least we aren't headed out of town. Not yet, anyhow. I catch glimpses of passing street signs, but the names are unfamiliar. The van makes a final turn and coasts to a stop. Then I hear a squeal of hinges. We pass through a set of steel gates and move slowly down what looks like an alley lined in garage doors. Of course, a self-storage facility. Where else to stash stolen antiques? Moments later, the SUV backs up to one of the units and comes to a full stop. I hear the doors open and shut, and a woman rolls up the door on the storage unit and starts unloading. To my intense disappointment, I don't recognize her before she drapes a padded blanket over me.
"Careful!"
a low voice warns from behind me. Man? Woman? I can't tell. At least I'm being handled gently. They ease me down onto the concrete floor. I can't see through the blanket, and I'm starting to feel claustrophobic. What would they do if I suddenly screamed? I'm too scared to find out. In no time at all, I hear the door roll down and the van drives away. I immediately concentrate all my will to fight my way out of that blanket. It's pitch black here, and cold. Cold. I feel along the edges of the door. If there's a way to release the lock from inside, I can't find it. I'm 13 years old. Way too old to start bawling like a baby, even if I am freezing. Nothing for it but to burrow back into that padded blanket and remember how I wound up in this fix. I probably wouldn't be here if my mother hadn't been struck by lightning when I was 3. It was a bolt out of the blue. Literally. No chance to take cover or escape. Dad's mom came to live with us, but when she died 5 years later, Dad decided I was old enough to do without a babysitter. Every morning since then, he pours us each a bowl of cereal and drops me off at school with lunch money. After school, I walk the 8 blocks to his antique store where I do my homework, then read or help out. Supper is usually a bowl of canned soup or the evening special at a nearby restaurant. Back at the house, Dad reads one of his many auction catalogs he gets in the mail, or we watch Antiques Roadshow on the History Channel. We're both in our beds by 9 o'clock. At least he is. Lately, I've been sneaking back downstairs and out into the backyard to test the limits of what I can do. He's a rather absent-minded father, a kindly man more interested in the past than the present.
He doesn't care about my A's in math or science as long as I can make at least a C in history and know that a Chippendale is a desirable piece of furniture and not a desirable male stripper. Friends? Hey, I've got friends. Lots of friends. Okay, maybe not close friends. My classmates like me well enough, though. I get asked to all the birthday parties, despite being something of a loner. I'm pretty good with a computer, but I don't do Facebook. I don't text or Twitter either, so no one's ever claimed me as her best friend. I don't mind. Honest, when I was a little kid, the shop was more fun than any play date, and as long as I was careful and put everything back where it belonged, Dad used to let me amuse myself with the antique toys or the cases of estate jewelry. In short, I was as normal, or what passes for normal, as any other little girl until the hormones kicked in last spring, and I suddenly became a woman, as our gym teacher put it. It was not as huge a trauma for me as for some of my older classmates who had to endure sniggers and crude remarks from gorky boys whose voices were cracking like peanut brittle. Mrs. Kim had thoroughly explained what was going to happen to us, and I had watched most of the girls in my class become women before it happened to me, so I was prepared. I had begun to wear a small bra, and I had a package of sanitary pads stashed in the back of the linen closet. Unfortunately, my first period began during the last period of school one warm spring day. Even more unfortunately, I was wearing white clam diggers. As soon as I walked out of the classroom and headed down the sidewalk toward the store, it was as if there were a gang of feral dogs on my trail. Three pimply-faced boys who jeered and called, "Hey, Laurel, what'd you do, sit down and catch up?" And, "Ooh, Laurel, hurt yourself? Want us to call a doctor?" One of them pulled out his cell phone to take pictures of my backside. Embarrassed and humiliated, I began to run, which of course only encouraged them. The store seemed miles away, and as I darted around a corner, the only hiding place in sight was a thick hedge of azalea bushes in full bloom. Even as I dived into them and buried myself among the leafy branches, I knew it was a mistake. With nowhere else to look, they would surely zero in on the head-high azaleas.
"Hey, where'd she go?"
I heard one of the panting boys ask when he turned the corner and saw the empty sidewalk ahead.
"There's her book bag," said another. "She must be in the bushes."
I froze as they pushed aside the flowering twigs. One acne-inflamed face was so close to mine, I could have spit on it, yet he didn't seem to see me.
"What do you boys think you're doing?"
a woman suddenly screeched from her doorway.
"Is that you, Thomas Bertram? You break any of my bushes and I'm calling your mother."
Tommy's mother is built like a Humvee, and it's rumored that she keeps a leather strap hanging in her kitchen. The speed with which Tommy took off down the sidewalk behind his friends makes me believe the rumors. When the woman walked out into her yard, I wanted to run too, but every instinct told me to stay still, don't move. To my surprise, the woman didn't seem to see me either. Muttering to herself about destructive kids today, she pushed aside the twigs and azalea flowers to look for damage. Her frown deepened.
"That's odd," she said. "I don't remember a white azalea here."
I winced as she put out her hand to me and plucked a flower. It felt as if she had pulled out some of my hair, but I managed not to yelp. When she walked away, I tried to leave, but I couldn't move. To my horror, I was no longer flesh and blood. My fingers were leafy twigs, my curly hair ruffled white flowers. I tried to scream, but I had no voice, no mouth, no larynx. Eventually, panic gave way to despair. The legend of Daphne and Apollo was familiar to me because of my name. Daphne had turned into a laurel tree to escape being raped by a horny god, whereas I, Laurel Hudson, had changed into an azalea to escape that bunch of adolescent jackals. But Daphne had wanted to become a tree, while I suddenly realized that, yeah, okay, when I dived into this clump of bushes, I did want to merge with them and disappear. There was nothing in the legend to suggest that Daphne ever regretted becoming a laurel tree and wanted to be human again. But if I wanted it as desperately as I wanted to hide, "I want to be a girl again. I want to be a girl again," I chanted mutely. Nothing. I was still an azalea.
"It's pretty, Jean," said a voice above me, "but I don't recognize this variety. You really need to water it, though. It's starting to wilt."
"I watered this whole bed last night,"
said the woman who had chased away my tormentors.
Evidently, she had brought a gardening friend out to see me.
Maybe it needs more water than usual. Tomorrow I'll dig it up, prune it back, and move it around to the patio where I can keep an eye on it.
Dig me up? Prune me back? As soon as they went back into the house, I concentrated on skin, hair, teeth, toenails, summoning up all the pictures of blood veins and nervous systems in my health and science textbook. To my total relief, my twigs abruptly became fingers again. My flowers were hair, my branches arms and legs. I scrambled out of the bushes, grabbed my book bag, and ran to the shop. Dad was too busy with a customer to notice that I was almost an hour late. I was stunned by what had happened to me, but I was still a kid, and over the next 3 days I almost convinced myself that I had imagined it all. Then it happened again. I was polishing a Victorian armchair that Dad had recently acquired. As I ran my oiled cloth over the carved filigrees, working the cloth into every dusty cranny, I suddenly heard the voice of Doom from the front of the store. Aunt Verna, Dad's older sister. Twice a year she passes through town on her way to and from her summer house in Maine, and she always stops by the store so that we can take her to lunch, where she spends the whole meal telling me to sit up straight, not to talk with my mouth full, and to speak up, child. I asked you a question. She finds fault with everything I do or say or wear, and to make matters worse, the last time she was here, she saw that I had taken to wearing a bra, and she leaned over the table to ask in an arch whisper if I'd had a visit from my little friend down south yet. I pretended I didn't know what she meant, and when she noticed Dad's puzzled look, she let it drop. Just remember, though, Laurel, I'm your only female relative, and if you have any questions, you can always come to me. As if. I so wanted to avoid another lunch with Aunt Verna that before I knew it, I had changed into a duplicate of the chair I had been polishing.
That wasn't very kind of you to disappear like that and leave me to face your aunt alone,
Dad told me later. Sorry, I said, and tried to look contrite. I spent the whole weekend experimenting with my strange new talent, and it didn't take me long to figure out how to get even with Tommy Bertram. He and his two pals usually stopped at Elm and Madison every afternoon before splitting off to their own houses. They would lean against a lamp post or on the sturdy blue and red steel mailbox that stood on the corner and snicker about which girls had the biggest racks and how studying was for nerds. So juvenile. So stupid. They never noticed when a second blue and red steel mailbox appeared beside the first one. Next day, I slipped notes into the lockers of a couple of eighth-grade boys whose girlfriends I'd heard them trashing. And guess what? After school, those three got their butts kicked big time. Oh, and guess what else? 10 minutes into the unit test, our history teacher found the cheat notes Tommy had taped to his arm. So it was a real bad day for him all around. While my new talent was useful for avoiding unpleasant aunts and getting back at obnoxious boys, I didn't see any real benefits until this winter when things started to go missing from the store. Dad owns the store, but he rents space to several other dealers and takes the money for them when they're not there. As the economy got worse, more and more people came into the shop offering quality heirlooms, but fewer and fewer of the walk-ins were buying. Without our internet website, Dad might have had to close the store. As it was, three of our dealers had to pack it in, and for a while their rental spaces stood empty. Just when trade dropped off to its slowest after Christmas, someone came in to ask if we would sell some things she had recently inherited.
It's stuff my mother's great-grandfather acquired when he was in the China trade back in the 1890s.
Dad tried to explain that he knew very little about Chinese antiques, but the woman wouldn't take no for an answer. Next day she arrived with a pile of cartons, some odd pieces of furniture, and a document that authorized him to sell everything for a generous percentage of the net.
You're sure about this?
Dad asked dubiously as the movers stacked the boxes in a room near the front counter that serves as both a workroom and temporary storage.
I'm positive. I need the money. But what about an inventory?
Dad said.
Do you even know what's here or what the pieces are worth?
I'm not worried, the woman told him.
You sold some things for a friend of mine, and she says you're the most honest man she's ever met.
As soon as she left, we opened a couple of cartons at random. Inside were amazing porcelains, bronzes, and stone animals. Tucked in among the boxes were several lacquered chests and screens.
Everything was meticulously documented in an old ledger book, which also held the original bills of sale. While Dad gave himself a crash course on Chinese antiques, I took pictures and uploaded them to our eBay account. We put a dozen decorative items up for auction right away, and at the end of 2 weeks, we were both astonished to see the prices they brought, mostly from people with Chinese names.
"They've got the money now,"
said Mr. Fong, one of our new dealers, as he watched me pack up a small stone foo dog to ship to the West Coast. He shook his head enviously.
"A few years ago, it was the Japanese. Now it's the Chinese who want to buy their history back."
Could Mr. Fong have been the second person in the SUV? Was he the one who cautioned the woman to be careful with me? Our shoplifter? Dad may not deal in museum-quality antiques, but he does have high standards, and he requires that our dealers meet those standards by frequently refreshing their displays. Some of them rent space in 3 or 4 different stores, which means that they're constantly moving things in and out, and that they're not always clear about what's where. When we take a customer's money, we save the tag that was on the item because it has the dealer's ID number and the asking price. That goes into the till with the customer's payment, whether cash, check, or plastic, and that's when a dealer will delete it from his inventory list. It was Martha Cook, a dealer who's been with Dad for years, who first noticed that she was missing a small occasional table. Mass-produced, mid-20th century, but made of solid mahogany and in beautiful condition. Good value for the $75 Martha was asking. Then Jimmy Weston reported that a pair of bronze bookends had vanished from his space.
"Who the hell steals $20 bookends?"
he asked indignantly. "A klepto?" wondered Jane Armstead, the part-time clerk who covered for Dad when he's on a buying trip and I'm in school. "There's no other logic to what's being taken." Jane's a divorced freelance artist who's put on a few pounds over the years. Her long hair is streaked with gray now, and she just coils it around and secures it to the top of her head with hairpins and a couple of ivory chopsticks. Her clothes used to be shabby chic. Now they're just shabby because her commissions have fallen off. Even though she's worked here off and on since I was in kindergarten, Jane is a little ditzy and no expert in antiques. But she was right about the illogic of the thefts. The only thing Jimmy Weston's bronze bookends had in common with a trio of 1930s lead soldiers, a chipped Art Deco vase, and a pair of Kendall Loring silver-plated candlesticks was their portability. Nor were they worth much. Except for Martha's table, nothing was priced at over $50. "They took your candlesticks and left the sterling toast rack that was sitting right beside it," said Jane. "Weird."
"Indeed,"
Ms. Loring said crisply.
"Especially since the toast rack is Georgian and worth 5 times the candlesticks."
Dad started listing the Chinese things on eBay in the middle of January. 3 new dealers joined the store in February, and the shoplifting began soon after that. "It has to be one of those 3, I think, as my eyes adjust to the darkness. Is it coincidence? Or did they suddenly show up because they saw those Chinese things on eBay and thought they could come clean us out? I see a paper-thin line of light where the door doesn't fit the sill completely. Oh, no real help. There's nothing I can change into that would let me move through such a narrow opening. As the March chill penetrates my prison, I move farther away from the cold metal roll-up door and fumble around till I find a second padded blanket to insulate me from the concrete floor while I think about those new dealers. Thomas Fong is from San Francisco, late 40s, married, though we'd never seen his wife. With that name, you'd expect someone small, dark, and inscrutable. You'd be wrong. He's tall, blue-eyed, and 4 generations removed from the mainland. But his Chinese roots led him to an appreciation of classical Chinese antiques, and he specializes in decorative pieces of Asian origin.
"Unfortunately, they're mostly things that were made for export and not very old,"
he told me.
"Post-1945.
Very nosy. Forever trying to get a look inside the storage room. Even though he's not there every day, he always seems to be around when I photograph a new batch of items. Next comes Kendall Loring from Detroit. Mid-30s, still single. Skinny, brown hair that's curlier than mine. And she's even nosier than Mr. Fong. First day in the door, she's asking questions about school and who my friends are and what my mom was like and if I think Dad will ever get married again. Sort of cute, but way too young for Dad. If I were on Facebook, she'd probably be banging at the electronic door, begging to be my friend.
Says she doesn't like Chinese arts and deals only in estate jewelry and silver. Could she have been the second person in the van? Maybe her candlesticks weren't really stolen. Maybe that was to keep us from suspecting her when other things disappeared. Last is a youngish widow from New York City, Neva Earle, 40 and fighting it. Friendly enough, but more reserved than either Fong or Loring. Her space is an eclectic mix of porcelain and ceramics, everything from Staffordshire dogs to beautiful Dresden plates. Would she... Oh my God, what's that noise? It sounds almost like someone's touching a sheet of bubble wrap. Mice? Rats? I squint through the gloom, but it's too dark to see anything distinctly. I flounce my blanket to flush whatever creature it is and to get a fix on its location. But all is silent again. Nerves, I mutter to myself. Eventually, I relax and go back to analyzing the situation. Despite all our care in watching our customers like a hawk, occasionally small items continued to walk off. Jane started asking customers to leave their tote bags at the front counter when she was covering the store for Dad, but he couldn't bring himself to do it.
"It'll look like we don't trust them," he said.
"We don't," Jane and I chorused. Things finally came to a head last week. My fault. We keep the storeroom locked, of course, but once an item's been listed online, I'm not as careful as I should be about putting it back under lock and key. When Dad went to crate up a lacquered chest that had sold for well over its $2,000 reserve, it was gone. I had covered it with an old patchwork quilt and left it on the floor beside the table I use as a staging platform for my camera. Instead of the Chinese chest, the patchwork quilt covered a plain oak chest of our own that was worth only a fraction of the other. The police came and poked around, but what could they do? No door had been forced, and taking fingerprints in such a public place would have been useless.
"We'll file an incident report so you can put in an insurance claim,"
they told Dad.
"But you might want to change your locks. Looks like an inside job by someone with a key."
"Well, that's stupid," I told Dad when they were gone. "You and Jane have the only keys, and Jane hasn't been in since I left the chest out."
"Of course it wasn't Jane," said Dad. "I hate to say it, but I'm afraid it must be one of the new people. All three of them restocked their booths this week, so they were back and forth with dollies. If you could remember when you last saw the chest..."
But I couldn't. This was Thursday. I knew it was there last Saturday morning because a customer had been interested in the quilt until she realized that one end of it had been damaged in a fire. But the chest could have been taken 20 minutes later, and who would notice? Dad was due to be out of town all weekend for an antique fair. I had finally convinced him that I was old enough to stay home alone. But as soon as he left Friday morning, I ditched school and headed for the shop. Jane was behind the counter and surprised to see me. "No school. Teacher work day," I said glibly. "I'm going to take pictures of another box of stuff in the storeroom." No sooner had I unlocked the door and switched on the light inside than Mr. Fong was right there at my elbow. He insisted on helping me carry things out to my tabletop photography studio. This time, I didn't discourage him. He wasn't particularly interested in a tall ceramic statue of a goddess.
"Early 20th century, made for export in a dime a dozen,"
he said dismissively. But a Ming Dynasty vase with a scaly blue dragon prancing around the flared bowl really made him salivate. "Lovely," said Neva Earle on her way in with a heavy box of English stoneware strapped to her dolly. She held a blue willow platter next to the vase and said ruefully,
"You can certainly see the difference in quality, can't you?"
"I don't know," said Martha Cook. "I have a weakness for blue willow. You ought to let me display that platter for you on one of my sideboards."
They walked away together, and a customer called Mr. Fong back to his booth to discuss a Korean screen. I finished photographing the Ming vase and moved on to the ceramic goddess. She might not be valuable, but her serene face, half the size of my own, appealed to me, and I took several pictures of her from all angles.
"You have a nice touch with the camera," said Kendall Loring, who had suddenly appeared from nowhere. "I checked out your website. Good, crisp pictures."
"Thanks," I muttered.
"I guess you got your eye for form from your dad," she said.
"What about your mom? Was she a photographer, too?"
I shrugged. "Dad never said, Miss Loring."
"Please call me Kendall. You don't look much like him, so I guess you must take after her."
"I wouldn't know," I said. "She didn't like to have her picture taken."
"No pictures at all?"
"Just a snapshot he took when she wasn't expecting it.
I said grudgingly.
Was she as pretty as you?
Oh, please, I thought to myself.
Does it still hurt for him to talk about her?
God, but she was nosy. But her questions made me realize how little I knew about my mother. Could she have been a shapeshifter, too? Even though he never brought her up, Dad certainly answered every question I'd ever thought to ask. They had met in college, the only child of two only children. Her father died when she was in college, and her mother 3 years later. As the only grandchild on both sides of her family, she had inherited a ton of beautiful old pieces, which is how she and Dad started the store. No other family that he'd ever heard about. But where she was born, her maiden name, her favorite songs and movies, I'd never thought to ask. And there was no way I could say, "Hey, Dad, Mom ever change into a rocking chair when you weren't looking?" Not that I was going to tell Miss Call Me Kendall Loring any of this. I made a big show of being absorbed in my work, and she eventually took the hint and went back to her booth. Leaving the Ming vase on the table, I shoved the ceramic goddess back into the storeroom and locked the door. Behind the counter, Jane was absorbed in pulling up type fonts on the computer. As a freelance artist, she mixed aesthetic commissions with commercial ones and was always looking for ideas. She told me she hadn't sold a thing since Christmas except for a Valentine poster, so money was tight for her. I saw that she was totally oblivious to me and no one else was around. 2 seconds later, I was a copy of the ceramic goddess. Talk about boring. I watched all day, but the only time it got halfway interesting was when Mr. Fong paused to admire the vase again and asked Jane if I'd meant to leave it out like that.
Isn't Laurel afraid someone will walk off with it?
Jane had missed our earlier comments about the worth of the vase and gave an indifferent shrug. She'll probably come back and put it away. Shortly before closing time, I shifted back into my own shape. Oh, there you are, said Jane. She closed her sketchbook, logged off the computer, and began totaling up the day's meager receipts. I thought you were going to help me out on the counter. Sorry, I said, making a dash for the restroom. Although I could somehow see and hear in my changed state, I didn't feel hunger, thirst, or any other bodily needs. The instant I changed back, though, my bladder felt like it was going to pop and I was ravenously hungry. Kendall Loring was on her way out as I helped Jane lock up. I hadn't realized she was still in the store. As she pulled on her gloves and tightened a blue wool scarf around her neck, she gave me a hopeful smile and said, "Could I buy you supper?"
"Why, thanks, I'd love that," said Jane.
She was busy setting the burglar alarm and didn't realize the invitation was meant for me alone. A blast of icy March wind stung my cheeks when we stepped outside and waited for Jane to turn the key in the lock. I managed a fake smile of regret.
"That's awfully nice of you, Miss Loring, but I have to read a book for a school report."
"Thanks, anyhow. You and Jane have fun." Sitting here in my dark, icy prison, the memory of her sour look gives me my first smile since I'd been locked in.
"You missed a good meal, Laurel,"
Jane said when I got to the store this morning. "Best steak I've had in ages, and Kendall's so interesting to talk to. We must have rattled on for 2 hours." Didn't take a genius to know who did the rattling. By the time their dinner was over, Kendall Loring had probably heard everything Jane knows about Dad and me. Once I'd finished my usual Saturday morning chores, I put the Ming vase back on my photography table and fiddled with the camera some more. When I was sure that all the dealers in the store knew the vase was there, I draped an old tablecloth over it to look as if I was trying to disguise it. Because Saturday is our busiest day, it was almost noon before I found a safe time to shift into the shape of that ceramic goddess. At least it was more interesting than yesterday. More people in and out. Martha Cook sold a nice Sheridan-style china cabinet, and Jimmy Weston finally unloaded a large gilt-framed mirror that he'd been switching from store to store for several months. Thomas Fong came by to lift the cloth on the vase and run his hand over it enviously.
"Careful you don't rub the scales off that dragon,"
Neva Earle teased as she passed him on her way out of the store. At one point, I thought I had spotted a shoplifter. When a woman took a needlepoint cushion from a nearby stand while Jane was away from the counter and brazenly walked out of the store with it. She brought it right back, though, and I realized that she had a swatch of upholstery in her other hand and had merely wanted to see if the two colors matched in natural light. I was so busy watching her that I didn't realize that someone had approached from the other side until a heavy cloth was thrown over me. A moment later I was wheeled out to the sidewalk on a dolly and shoved into the back of the van. The cloth slipped enough for me to see a pair of female hands cushion the Ming vase in a cardboard box beside me, and that was it, until those same hands unloaded me at the storage facility and locked me inside. I must have slept, because that thin line of light beneath the door is even thinner now. Sunset. And I still haven't come up with a way out of this predicament. I could turn into water, I mutter aloud to myself. Run under the sill and onto the pavement. Like a whispered thought came a soft, no. My own subconscious telling me what I want to hear. I've been afraid to try liquids. Too amorphous. What if I couldn't hold it together and soaked into the ground? What if there's a storm drain right outside this door and I'm swept down to lose my identity in dirty water before all of me seeps past the sill? A moment later, I hear a vehicle stop outside and voices. A key turns in the lock. Before the door rolls up, I drop my blankets, push my way deeper into the locker, and shift into the shape of a cardboard box tall enough to see over the other boxes. As light floods in, I see for the first time an upright, 5-foot-tall wooden bear identical to one in the store. They must have stolen it when they took me. I focus my attention on the two women. They're silhouetted against the sunset, and I can't immediately make out their faces. "Where's the goddess?" one of them says, taking a step closer. "I left it right there," says the other one. "You idiot! You brought that stupid bear!" The other starts to protest, when suddenly the bear gives a tremendous roar. To their horror, it lurches forward and swipes its claws at the woman in front. Terrified, both women bolt screaming down the alleyway. The bear drops to all fours, growls menacingly, then stops and turns toward me. I concentrate on being cardboard. I think cardboard thoughts and try to give off a cardboard smell. The bear laughs and says,
"It's okay, Laurel. You can come out now."
A shimmer of fur, and there's Kendall Loring. I stare at her, stupefied, and slowly shift into my own shape.
"I see you didn't think to wear a coat either," she says. "Come on, let's see if they left a cell phone in the car."
I'm too stunned to argue, and just follow her meekly out to the car where we find a purse and a cell phone. When the women get up the nerve to return, we're locked inside the SUV with the heater going, and Kendall's called the police. They bang on the windows and threaten us with 7 kinds of hurt until a police cruiser pulls up outside the gate, and an agile young patrol officer climbs over the gate and demands to know what's going on. Neva Earle tries to bluster her way out of it, but she and her accomplice sound crazy when they start raving about a bear. And besides, I've identified the lacquered chest that she stole from the store last week. The police take us down to the station to sort it all out. Kendall tells a convincing story of how we saw them take the Ming Dynasty vase from the store and followed them. They don't think to ask where Kendall's car is or how we got past the locked gate. The vase and the chest are enough for them to charge Neva Earle and her partner, and the nice young patrol officer drives us both to Kendall's apartment. That's where I learn that she's my cousin. My grandmother actually had 2 daughters, not 1, as I've been told.
"My mom was a shapeshifter, too," Kendall says. "Only our grandparents were horrified and so scared of her that she ran away from home when she was 16. Your mom was only 4 at the time, and maybe they never told her she had an older sister. When I finally got Mother to tell me her real name, her parents were dead and no one knew what happened to your mom. One of the neighbors thought she'd married a man named Hudson." "Do you know how many Hudsons there are?"
I shake my head.
"Thousands,"
she says grimly. "From Alaska to Florida. 2 years ago, though, Mother was on eBay looking at jewelry for our store in Detroit, and she spotted this." She hands me an oval cameo brooch, set in gold and rimmed with garnets. White on pink, it's carved with the profiles of 3 women. Nothing I'd ever wear, I had assured my dad when I asked if I could put it on eBay along with some other pieces of antique jewelry. I think it fetched around $300. "It was my grandmother's," I say.
"I know. My mom recognized it."
"You came here because of a brooch?"
"Mother's gone," she says simply. "I suppose you could say she drowned. She was dying of cancer, and last summer she just merged into Lake Michigan. I have no other family."
She won't beg. I can see that. "Okay," I say at last. "But you have to teach me how to do animals. I can't keep myself from wilting when I'm a plant, so I've been afraid to try a living form. She laughs and shifts into the shape of a large golden retriever and almost licks me to death before I can make her stop. Oh, and the shoplifter? The next time Jane covered for Dad, I said, I'm sorry you're having a rough time right now, Jane, but you can't steal any more money, okay? See, the stolen items were portable, but they were also so cheap that most customers wouldn't bother with a credit card. On Saturday morning, I watched a woman pay cash for a blue willow cup and saucer from Neva Earle's booth. Jane pointed out a tiny chip on the underside of the saucer and told her it was being sold as is, meaning it could not be returned. Then she simply pocketed the cash. I suppose I should have had her fired or arrested, but she's been around since I was a baby. Besides, business is starting to pick up again, so Dad has her working more hours, and she's gradually paying back what she stole. Dad's as absent-minded as ever, but he's noticed that Kendall and I are friends. I'm still not totally convinced that Kendall's interested only in me and not Dad, too, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. A cousin's one thing. A shape-shifting stepmom's quite another. Oh, and last week, I changed into a tiger and scared Tommy Bertram so bad he wet his pants. Wait till he sees my dragon.
The Trespassers by Brendan Dubois. I was dreaming that something was chewing on my ankles when the phone thankfully rang, and I fumbled at the side of the bed and grabbed the cordless phone and murmured something intelligible into the receiver. I looked at the blood-red numerals of the clock radio and saw that it was 2:34 a.m., a hellish time for about anything, especially a phone ringing in the dark. The female voice on the other end said, "Sorry to wake you, Chief, but you've got a situation." I yawned, scratched at an intimate place or two, and swung around and put my feet on the carpet. Behind me, my wife, Tracy, kept on slumbering. Sweet girl, she could sleep through most everything, including a Cat 5 hurricane hammering at the windows. "Go ahead. What's going on?" I asked. The voice, which I now recognized as one of the duty dispatchers for the county, said, "You've got an untimely death." Damn, I thought. It was Saturday morning. This meant that I probably had to kiss the weekend goodbye, even though I had earlier promised Tracy a nice drive south to visit her parents in Concord. But with an untimely death in town, that was all done. "Go on." "Where?"
14 Mass Road. Officer Harris is there securing the scene.
14? Did you say 14 Mass Road?
That's right, Chief.
Damn. The Logan place. Tracy shifted on the other side of the bed and then started gently snoring. I yawned, scratched myself in another, somewhat less intimate place, and said, "All right. Tell Harris I'm rolling. Should be there in about 15 minutes. All right?"
"Absolutely," the dispatcher said. "You want me to contact the state police?"
I hesitated. Protocol demanded that the state police be called in for something like this, especially in a small town like Salem Falls, New Hampshire, which had a 3-man police department, one-third of which was on vacation, one-third of which was on the job, and one-third of which was sitting in a pair of pajama bottoms talking to a young lady who probably wasn't more than 21 years of age. "No, that's all right," I said. "I'll take care of it when I get to the scene." I sensed the uneasiness coming through the phone line, but she was a professional and said,
"As you say, Chief."
I hung up the phone and managed to get dressed and out the door without waking my wife or our two girls, ages 8 and 5, which I thought was a major accomplishment. In my cruiser, the engine started on the third try, and I backed out to Rutland Road, where I live with my family. I flipped on the heater as I drove down Rutland, the headlights picking up the dead leaves scattered across the cracked asphalt. It was the middle of October, just a couple of weeks left before Halloween, but I didn't see any trick-or-treaters about. Just quiet homes with one or two displaying a flickering blue light in the window that either meant an insomniac or someone who had fallen asleep while watching The Tonight Show. There were also a couple of lighted displays of pumpkins or witches from those who really enjoyed celebrating this time of year, and I'm sure they were new arrivals to our fair town. And speaking of lights, I didn't bother switching on the overhead light bar. I knew 14 Mass Road quite well. Knew I'd be there in less than 10 minutes, and so what was the point of switching on the strobes and getting all gung-ho?
But I did switch on the Motorola police radio, slung underneath the dash, and contacted the same polite woman I had talked to earlier. County, this is Salem Falls, Unit 1, responding to 14 Mass Road. And her brisk voice replied, Salem Falls, Unit 1, 10-4. And I resumed driving, shivering in the coldness of the cruiser's interior, wondering what in hell I was about to step into, and also wondering if the fine townspeople of Salem Falls would finally purchase me a new police cruiser at the next town meeting. 14 Mass Road was on the left side of a narrow country road, at the top of a hill that offered great views of the Montcalm Valley and the Green Mountains of Vermont over on the other side of the border. The house was an old Victorian, 3 stories tall, painted yellow with white and black trim. It had a nicely trimmed lawn and a wraparound porch, and I saw a Salem Falls police cruiser parked in the driveway behind a white Ford van, which, in turn, was parked behind a light blue Volvo. It looked like most of the lights were on inside, and I was happy to see that the cruiser, operated by Officer Melanie Harris, had its strobe lights off. Nothing like flashing lights to get attention, and even in a small town like Salem Falls, it would take just under an hour for most of the adult population to know something was amiss at the Logan place. I pulled over on the side of the road, the driveway being full, and called off one more time to dispatch. Salem Falls, Unit 1, off at the scene. Heard a quick reply, and then switched off the engine. I got out and walked up a flagstone path to the porch and checked out the Ford van. It had Massachusetts plates, which got my attention. And on the side of the van was one of those magnetic signs that said NEGH, with a 1-800 phone number underneath, and some odd logo with a broomstick and sheet. I went up the porch steps, past a couple more Halloween decorations. The door opened up, and Officer Melanie Harris came out, shaking her head, a slight smile on her chubby face. Chief, you're really not going to believe this one. Tell me what you got, I interrupted. Let's start with that. County dispatch said untimely death. The fire department been called out? I called them right after I had dispatch call you. They should be here in a few minutes. Okay, go on. It was chilly out on the porch, and I looked through some transparent white lace curtains. I saw what looked to be 3 people sitting in a living room. I rubbed my hands, and Harris looked through her notepad and said, What we have here is Ralph Toland and his wife, Carrie. They've lived here just under a year. Ralph runs some sort of online financial service company, and his wife helps with the books and billing. Where are they originally from? Vermont. Oh, I said, and saw the twinkle in Melanie's eyes with the way I pronounced the word. Years ago, during my grandparents' time, Vermont was a state not unlike New Hampshire. Solid Republican, flinty Yankee, self-sufficient, low taxes, that sort of thing. But now Vermont was just a suburb for rich New Yorkers, just like the southern part of our state was a suburb for rich Massachusetts types. Right. Oh, she said, referring back to her notes. And who's the other guy in there with them? She flipped a page in the notebook. This is where it gets interesting, Chief. The other fellow in the living room, that's Josh Lincoln. He was one half of a team from the NEGH. The NE what? She cocked her head. You don't watch much cable TV, do you, Chief? I said, Mostly it's Nickelodeon or the Food Network. Look, don't keep me guessing. Sorry, she said. NEGH, New England Ghost Hunters. Josh and his buddy Peter Grolin, they belong to this outfit that hunts ghosts, spirits, paranormal phenomena, that sort of thing. They go to haunted houses or other buildings, stake them out for the night, film their results, and it gets shown on one of those weird cable channels in the high numbers. They were spending the night here, and something happened, and Peter, well, Peter, he's dead. Oh, Christ, I said. Ghost hunters. Here. Did you find out whose bright idea that was? The male half of the Vermont immigrants, Melanie said. I guess, well, he claims that he and his wife, ever since they moved into the place, there's been, quote, events, unquote. And the wife, she's thinking of turning the place into a bed and breakfast. Like this county needs another Victorian bed and breakfast. Another smile from my young officer, who's the daughter of the selectman chairman, and who works twice as hard to prove she doesn't get any favors. She said, But that's the deal, Chief. This one, they could say it was haunted. That, plus the view of Vermont and the buttered scones for breakfast, I guess they thought that was a selling point. I tried to peer through the window. Just saw the three shapes, sitting there silently. But what happened to Peter? Melanie's smile faded a bit. You can see for yourself. Kinda gross. Looks like he took a fall from the third floor stairs, went down to the second floor landing, and, well, the railing for the landing. There was this lovely sculptured ear of corn, or something, on the railing. Very kitschy and decorative, but it had a sharp point, and went right through his throat. Bled right out, up there on the landing. I took my uniform hat off, rubbed at my head. All right. You got statements from all three of them? Yeah, she said. You got pictures and preliminary measurements? Yep, again. What's your gut telling you? She looked at me with a calm, clear expression and said, untimely death, that's all. Nothing suspicious. I stared right back at her. Okay, not bad. But you screwed one thing up. Oh? I motioned to the living room. You left the three of them alone in there while you were out talking with me. Those are all witnesses. They should be separated so they don't get a chance to chat and compare stories and come up with a nice little narrative, Melanie said. Good point, Chief. Won't do it again. But still, guy took a tumble. Sure, I said, going to the door. But if we find out later that somebody in here pushed him, the Attorney General will be all over our ass. Look, stay out here and keep the eager beavers from the fire department from coming in. You've done well, she smiled. Thanks, Chief. And so I opened the door and entered what was technically a crime scene, but which I thought was something else as well. If I was concerned about a crime being committed, I suppose I should have checked out the body of the recently deceased, but I was more interested in talking to the witnesses, a.k.a. residents, who were in the house at the time the young man died. Sitting on a couch that looked overstuffed and upholstered like it belonged to some Manhattan designer's idea of what constituted Victorian style were Ralph and Carrie Toland. Ralph had on a pair of gray sweatpants and a T-shirt that said Colby, while his wife had a light blue terrycloth robe on, her white knuckled hands tight about the top. Her blonde hair was mussed and her eyes were red-rimmed, like she had been silently crying for the past hour. Ralph was about 10 years my junior, black hair cut nice and short, but his face was just a bit flabby and shocked, like he could not believe that his entire life had led up to this, a pleasant home in a pleasant town with a dead body on the next floor. Slumped in an easy chair that was an uneasy match to the couch was Josh Lincoln, who looked to be about the same age as our county dispatcher. He had on black sneakers, blue jeans, and a black long-sleeved T-shirt that had the same logo displayed on the van outside. There were tattoos on the back of his hands, and he had earrings in both ears. His dark hair was in a ponytail, and he was just staring at his feet. "Mr. Toland? Sir?" Ralph looked up, like he just recognized that someone else was in the room, and said, "Yes? Sir, I'm Chief Hoyt Graham, Salem Falls Police. Is there a place where we could talk, just for a few minutes? Just the two of us?" Sure, he said, getting up from the couch, squeezing his wife's free hand. "Sure, come with me." And then Carrie looked up at him, her face pinched, and whispered, "Your fault, damn you, your fault!" He sighed and ran a hand across the top of his head, and I followed him as he walked into a kitchen, flicking on a light. I took in all the stainless steel gear and thought my wife would drool at seeing such a display. He took a stool, and so did I, and I said, "I know you've talked to Officer Harris, but I just want to hear it from you. What happened?" He shook his head and sighed and said, "Damn. I mean, it seemed like a hoot at the time, you know. I was watching some TV last month, saw this program on the paranormal, and saw a bit on an outfit called the New England Ghost Hunters. And Carrie and I thought it would be great to have someone come here and investigate our house." "Sure," I thought. "Your idea and your wife's idea." I wasn't buying it, but I went on and said, "And what would be the purpose of this investigation?" He shrugged. "Some publicity. We're thinking of converting this place into a bed and breakfast, and we thought a television program about what's been going on here would be wonderful in getting our name out to the public. Has the planning board approved your proposal?" "Not yet, but our lawyer's confident it will get approval." I flipped over a page in the notebook and thought, "Then your lawyer doesn't know Salem Falls that well." But poor Ralph was already having a terrible night, so I didn't want to add to his misery. Aloud, I said, So tell me, sir, what's been going on that you thought about bringing in ghost hunters? Ralph looked embarrassed and said, Oh, stuff? Well, what stuff? Well, ever since we moved in, there's been incidents. I tried to keep the impatience out of my voice. Like what? I don't like games, Mr. Tolan, so tell me what's been going on here. What's occurred so that you felt compelled to bring in two strangers from Massachusetts to spend the night here, one of whom is now dead in your house? That certainly got his attention, and he stared at a point about a foot above my left shoulder and said, Little stuff at first. Carrie's always on me for leaving the toilet seat up, and I swear I always put the seat down, and she'd always find it up. And doors would open and shut by themselves. And you'd be walking down the stairs, and man, you'd just get a blast of cold air. And at night, well, sometimes it got worse at night. I didn't say a word, just waited, and he added, Just as you'd be drifting off to sleep, there'd be whispers out there. Whispers that you could barely hear. And when you'd sit up, they'd go away. Or if you went around thinking maybe the TV or the radio was left on, there'd be nothing. But back in bed, more whispers. And shadows on the wall. Odd lights that would just flicker at the corner of your eye. I sighed. Mr. Toland, this house is more than a century old. Odd things happen to the foundation. The house can settle and either close or open doors, make creaking noises, or let in drafts that'll freeze your fingers. Old pipes can rattle or gurgle water, make it sound like whispers. And lights, the eye can play tricks at night, especially when you're predisposed to think something's going on. He stopped staring over my shoulder and now looked at my face. He said, 2 weeks ago, my wife woke up screaming, saying something cold had grabbed onto her foot. And before you ask, no, it wasn't me. So don't tell me it's just an old house, all right? I went to my notebook. All right, we'll leave that be. No, tell me about these two ghost hunters. Another shrug. At the time, well, like I said, it was just a hoot. I called their 1-800 number. They came up here, asked if they could spend the night, and we said sure. They have all this gear, you know, cameras that can take pictures in the night, stuff that measures variations in temperature and electromagnetic radiation. I was going to stay up with them, but they said no, they get better results with the homeowners not being present. So Carrie and I went to bed, and just before 2 a.m., I woke up, heard some screaming, and then a thumping sound, and then more yelling. That's when I got out of bed. Where did you go? Up to where I heard Josh yelling about his bud Peter. His friend. It was awful. Blood everywhere. And that's when I had Carrie call 911. And what was Josh yelling about his friend Peter? Upset talk, that's all. That he had fallen, was bleeding hard. What was he going to tell his parents? Stuff like that. All right, I said. Is there anything else you can tell me that might help with our investigation? He shook his head. To think something like this would happen in our house. And I don't know. Maybe I was feeling grumpy or something for being woke up and having my weekend ruined, but I said, Oh, one thing, Mr. Toland, just so you know. What's that? Earlier you said this was your house. Not entirely accurate. This is the Logan House, named after the man who built it back in 1882. It may be your house for a while, but it will always be the Logan House. Funny thing, I know, but that's one of the funny things about small towns. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk to your wife for a few minutes. I don't think Mr. Toland liked being corrected like that, and truth be told, I didn't particularly care. Next, I spoke to Carrie Toland in her fine kitchen, which was mostly a waste of time. She was at times weepy and other times angry, and she mostly repeated what her husband had said, with one notable exception, that the visit of the alleged paranormal experts was entirely her husband's idea and not hers. And when Peter had died a couple of hours ago, she was fast asleep and heard a thump and yelling, and that's all she knew. She got up from bed with her husband, went upstairs to the second floor landing, and when she saw the blood on the stairs and the crumpled form of Peter, she retreated back downstairs to the living room and called 911. All right, I said, looking at my notebook. But tell me this. Your husband claims that ever since you moved into the house that there's been incidents. True? She tried to draw her bathrobe even closer about her neck. I don't know. Could you be a bit more precise, Mrs. Toland? Ralph, He's really the one who thinks something's been going on here. At first, it was a little joke, you know, that there was somebody else living here, somebody sharing our house. We even talked about charging rent or something. Just a little joke.
Was you waking up a couple of weeks ago, screaming that something had grabbed your leg? Was that a little joke? Her eyes were sharp, and I could just imagine what she'd be saying to her husband at the first opportunity about telling family secrets. And she said, "No, that was just a nightmare. Nothing else." Your husband believed otherwise.
Maybe so, but I never really believed. I just thought it was Ralph and his imagination.
And then her mood and voice changed.
His damn imagination. And look what it's brought us. A dead boy in the house. A dead boy.
She shivered and said bitterly,
"But maybe Ralph will be happy now. A real dead body in our house. Maybe that poor boy's spirit will haunt us now."
Then the sniffling started, and I patted her on the shoulder and said we were done for now. Josh Lincoln, the surviving 50% of the New England Ghost Hunters field team, seemed kind of shaky, so we sat at a dining room table in the rear, adjacent to the kitchen. I took notes as we talked, and after getting his age, hometown, and that usual stuff, I said, "So, how long have you been doing this kind of work?"
"Just over a year," he said glumly, looking down at his tattooed hands.
"What else you do?"
"Huh?"
I said gently. "Oh, come on, Josh. This can't be a paying gig, can it? What else do you do?" He looked a bit embarrassed.
"Tin bar, in Newburyport, Massachusetts."
"And your buddy Josh?"
"Dishwasher. Same place as me."
"So how did you end up doing this?" Josh shrugged.
"We love goth stuff. The supernatural, that sort of thing. King, Poe, Lovecraft. And Newburyport's got a lot of haunted history. We read up on ghosts and ghost hunting on the web. Seemed like fun, you know? Do stuff firsthand. Got some gear, made a connection with the cable station, and there you go."
"And probably get to boast some to the young ladies, right?" Just a hint of a smile.
"Maybe.
And how did you end up here in Salem Falls?"
"The guy that owns the house, he gave us a ring. And once we looked into the history of this house, man, what happened here?"
I held up a hand. "I know. The Logan place. I'm a native. I know all about it."
"Oh,"
he said. "So how many times have you done investigations like this?"
"About 10, 15 times," he said.
"Any ghosts? Spirits? Things that go bump in the night?" Josh rubbed his hands together.
"Indications? Increased levels of electromagnetic radiation. Some whispers caught on audio tape. Flashes of light. Stuff like that."
"But no pirate ghosts, waving a sword, that sort of thing?" He wiped at his eyes.
"Look, maybe you're having fun with this, you know, but my buddy's dead out there."
I felt properly chastened.
"My apologies.
You're right. Look, Josh, what happened when Peter came down the stairs? Where were you?" He took a breath.
"I was in the living room. There was some indication in the far corner. Just a sudden dip in the temperature. Peter was upstairs on the third floor. Then I heard him moving fast and a yell, and then he fell. I ran upstairs and just saw him there, bleeding. And it was so quick, you know. It didn't take long. The woman, Christ, I forget her name, she called 911, and then that woman cop showed up. And that's about that."
"All right," I said, making my last notes. "You said he yelled. Did you hear him say anything in particular?"
He wiped at his eyes again. I don't know. He said something."
"And what was that? What did he say?" Josh suddenly looked about 30 years older.
He said, "It's coming after me. It's coming after me."
Out in the living room, I saw the reflection of red strobe lights bouncing off the wallpapered walls. And on the porch, there were a handful of Salem Falls volunteer firefighters eager to do their job. I went out on the porch and nodded to my officer and spotted Skip Durbin, the chief of the volunteer fire department. He weighs about 300 pounds and needs to have a specially tailored fire coat, but he's been the chief for nearly a decade, and while his department may be volunteer, it is very professional. "Looks like an untimely death, Skip, but you know the drill. Can't move the body until the county medical examiner says he's dead." Skip, being a good sort, just nodded and said,
"State police coming?"
I said to Melanie, "Would you take care of that then? Contact the state police major crimes unit and the medical examiner?" Sort of slipped my mind. Melanie looked coolly at me and said,
"Not a problem, Chief."
Skip said,
"Mind if I get a look?"
I said, Give me a couple of minutes first, all right, Skip? I haven't seen the poor bastard yet. Just want to get first impressions by myself. Skip said,
Sure.
And I was going to ask him to have his guys switch off the red strobe lights, but he was being so agreeable, I let it pass. Back in the house, I ignored my three interviewees and decided it was finally time to see the death scene for myself. I went up the first floor steps, nice wide oak steps, and then to the landing, where I detected the odor of blood and other bodily fluids. The poor guy was dead, all right. He was crumpled up on his side, facing the living room, and his throat was a bloody mess. Blood had sprayed out onto the banister and the wall, no doubt from a severed artery. I stepped a bit closer. Peter looked to be about the same age as his friend downstairs. Had on jeans and black sneakers, and he had on the same kind of T-shirt, save his was short-sleeved, showing off tattoos on both bare arms. His eyes, thankfully, were closed. I looked up the stairs, going up to the third floor. Looked at the banister, an old carved ornate piece of work matching the adjacent railings. And my officer had been right. The railing here on the landing was low, much lower than any present-day building inspector would allow, and on either end of the railing there were carved decorative pieces that in fact looked like narrow corn cobs. The one at the end facing the stairs going down was nice and plain. The one at the end facing the stairs going up was bloody, and it looked like the top 3 or so inches had been broken off. I stepped around Peter and his pool of blood, looked upstairs to the third floor. This set of stairs was narrow and steeper, and the wood was highly polished. Easy to see what must have happened. The young guy was up on the third floor, got spooked, and tried to come downstairs quickly. Slipped on the steps, fell, and impaled his throat on that nice 100-year-old bit of decorative railing work. Untimely death, my officer had called it. I had confirmed it, and I was sure the medical examiner and whatever state police detective on duty tonight would sign off on it as well. Still, one more thing to look at. I felt a hint of cold air on the back of my neck. A draft from somewhere, no doubt. I looked down at Peter, saw a cassette recorder at his side, and about 2 feet away from his left hand, one of those miniature camcorders. I picked up the cassette recorder, reversed the tape a bit, and held it close to my ear so I could hear what was on there. I listened for a minute, and then stopped the tape, and then played with the tape controls for a moment. I put the cassette recorder down, picked up the camcorder, and repeated the process, looking through the narrow viewfinder, seeing what had been recorded. When I was done with that, I worked the controls one more time and then put everything back down on the floor. And then I felt that cold breeze upon the back of my neck again. I stood up. Upstairs, a door suddenly slammed shut, like the same errant breeze against my neck had caused it to close. And after that, I went downstairs, through the living room and outside to the porch. I smiled at the patient Skip. Go take a look before the circus starts. And the circus came and stayed for a few more hours, as the medical examiner looked at the body and confirmed that yes, indeed, the poor boy was dead, which allowed the patient volunteer firefighters of Salem Falls to remove the body and take it to the Pearson Funeral Home, next town over in Montcalm, but not before two polite and large state police detectives took their own photos, performed their own measurements, and interviewed the three witnesses. Eventually, the Tolans were left in the living room with my officer Harris while Josh sat on the porch. Then the two detectives and I huddled in the kitchen as the morning sun started streaming through the windows, and we eventually came to the logical and only conclusion that one Peter Groland of Newburyport, Massachusetts, had in fact died accidentally with no indication of foul play, and that the cassette recording and the camcorder recording showed no evidence that anything untoward had happened to the unfortunate young man. With that, we all wished that someone knew how to work the fancy coffee machine in the corner, because a hot cup of Joe would sure taste good right about now. And then the taller of the two detectives said, "So, this is the Logan place. Funny. Always heard about it, but never thought I'd be inside of it. Especially looking at a dead body. Ironic, huh?" His partner, who was trying to decipher the controls on the coffee machine, looked up and said, "What about the Logan House?" The other detective said, "Read more than Sports Illustrated. Maybe you'll learn something. Chief, you're a townie. Want to let my buddy here know about the Logan House?" I smiled and said, "Breck Logan built this place back in 1882.
was the wealthiest man in the county, built mills along the Connecticut River, and got even wealthier. Never married, never had any close relatives, and died in 1903. The detective by the coffee machine said,
"And that's it?"
The other detective laughed.
"Hell no! The chief isn't telling you the good stuff, the gory stuff, right?"
I nodded. Yeah, right. Story was, though never printed anywhere, that the good Mr. Logan was a devil worshipper, that he led a coven of devil worshippers, that his devil worship and the worship of the others allowed both him and the town to thrive, and that over the years, some French-Canadian girls who came down to work in the mills disappeared, that some of their fathers came down in 1903 to confront Mr. Logan about it, and before they could get any information out of him, he went upstairs to the attic of this house and blew his head off with a shotgun, and that some of the fathers from Quebec started digging on the property and found bones and skulls. End of story.
Right, the detective at the table said. End of story, but not of lesson.
What lesson? The other detective asked.
That these nice little villages and towns, they can have the darkest and bloodiest secrets imaginable. Even a pretty little town like Salem Falls, with a fancy-schmancy downtown, nice little computer firms and the old mill buildings, still doing fine. Right, Chief?
I smiled. All right. There came a moment then when the Logan house was empty, and I went back upstairs, past the blood-stained floor, and then upstairs again. I opened up the door and felt a blast of cold air on my face, and then took a set of very narrow and creaking steps up to the attic. There were boxes up there, piles of junk, and even though it was now daylight, it was still dark, with very little light streaming in from slats at either side of the attic. I rubbed my hands and looked into the darkness, and then let my eyes adjust to the lack of light. There was something off to the right. I ignored it, kept staring into the darkness, thinking about the night, thinking about what had happened, thinking of what I had learned. Thought about the cassette recorder and what I had heard, the shaky and frightened voice of Peter Grolin. "Something's going on up here. I don't know. I'm freezing, Josh. I'm freezing. And, oh, Christ, something's coming down the stairs. It's coming near me. It's coming after me. It's coming after me." Then the sound of something falling, something gurgling, and then the whisper of static. And what I had seen on the camcorder viewing screen, filmed in night vision. The same narrow steps leading up to the attic, the door opening, and an illuminated shape, oozing down, coming closer, closer. An illuminated shape, like the one I could see from the corner of my eye in the attic with me. I took a breath. You didn't have to do that. I know you were provoked, but you didn't have to do that. The shape flickered, moved. I took another breath. I promise you, things won't change. They won't get a permit for the bed and breakfast, and there won't be any more ghost hunters. No more trespassers. I promise. Okay? The shape flickered one more time and then disappeared. But not before I saw what was there. The slightly out-of-focus image of a man wearing a turn-of-the-last-century frock coat and pants, with a head that looked like a bloody shattered pumpkin. As I went back out to the porch, I had a warm thought that maybe the weekend could be salvaged after all. My wife and girls would be pleased. Outside, Josh was slowly loading some gear into his white van. The Tolden couple was having a heated discussion at one end of the porch, and the two state police detectives were conferring over their notebooks. I came down the stairs, yawning, and then the younger state detective, the one who had finally got the coffee machine up and running, came over to me and shook my hand.
"Nice to have met you, Chief," he said. "And I'm sure you hope you don't see us again any time soon."
I gave his hand a firm shake, smiling, since he was right. Since you only saw state police detectives in my line of work for serious matters.
"If you don't take offense, yeah, you're absolutely right."
He grinned and looked around at the Logan house, at its neighboring homes, and said,
"First time I've ever been in Salem Falls. Nice little town. Hell, a great little town. I've been through a lot of towns in this part of the state that are barely hanging on by their fingernails, but you guys have been lucky."
"Well, that we have," I said. Then the younger detective gave a forced little laugh, like he was trying to make a joke and knew he wasn't succeeding.
"You know, somebody might say that those old devil worshippers, they're still around, making sure the town still stays prosperous."
I looked at him, kept my expression slightly amused, and finally said,
You're right, some might say.